Without warning, the hook-nosed officer seized the back of Morghese's neck and bore her down prostrate beside him. Stunned, not least because the breath was knocked out of her, she saw him kiss the floor.
"Release her, Elbar," another woman drawled angrily. "The Queen of Andor is not to be treated so."
The man, Elbar, rose as far as his knees, head bent.
"I abase myself, High Lady. I beg forgiveness."
His voice was as cold and flat as that accent allowed.
"I have small forgiveness for this, Elbar."
Morghese looked up. Suroth took her aback. The sides of her head were shaved, leaving a glossy black crest across the top of her head and a mane that flowed down her back.
"Perhaps when you are punished, report yourself now. Leave me. Go."
A sweeping gesture flashed fingernails at least an inch long, the first two on each hand a glistening blue. Elbar bowed on his knees, then rose smoothly, backing away through the door. For the first time, Morghese realized none of the other soldiers had followed them in. She realized something else as well. He gave her one final glance before he vanished, and instead of flickering resentment for the one who had caused his punishment, he considered. There would be no punishment. The entire exchange had been arranged beforehand. Suroth swept toward Morghese, carefully holding her pale blue robe to keep her skirts exposed. Snow white, with hundreds of tiny pleats. Embroidered vines and lush red and yellow flowers spread across the robe. For all her sweeping, Morghese noticed the woman did not reach her until she had regained her feet on her own.
"You are unharmed?" Suroth asked. "If you are harmed, I will double his punishment."
Morghese brushed at her dress, so she would not have to look at the false smile that never touched the woman's eyes. She took the opportunity to look around the room. Four men and four women knelt against one wall, all young and more than good-looking. All wearing... She jerked her eyes away. Those long white robes were very nearly transparent. At the far sides of the screens, two more pairs of women knelt, one of each in the gray dress, one in the blue embroidered by lightning, bound by the silvery leash from wrist to neck. Morghese was not close enough to say for sure, but she had the sick-making certainty that the gray-clad women could channel.
"I'm quite all right, thank—"
A huge reddish-brown shape lay sprawled on the floor, a heap of tanned cowskins, perhaps. Then it heaved. "What is that?" She managed not to gape, but the question popped from her tongue before she could stop it.
"You admire my Lopar?"
Suroth swept away a good deal quicker than she had come. The enormous shape raised a great round head for her to stroke it under the chin with a knuckle. The creature put Morghese in mind of a bear, though it was easily half again as big as the largest bear she had ever heard tell of, and hairless to boot, with no muzzle to speak of, and heavy ridges surrounding its eyes.
"Al-Mandaragal was given to me as a pup for my first true name day. He foiled the first attempt to kill me that same year, when he was only a quarter grown."
There was real affection in the woman's voice. The Lopar's lips peeled back to reveal thick, pointed teeth as she stroked. Its forepaws flexed, claws sheathing and unsheathing, from six long toes on each. And it began to purr, a bass rumble fit for 100 cats.
"Remarkable," Morghese said faintly.
"True name day?" How many attempts had there been to kill this woman that she could speak of the first so casually? The Lopar whined briefly when Suroth left it, but quickly settled with its head on its paws. Disconcertingly, its eyes did not follow her, but settled mainly on Morghese, now and then flicking toward the door or the narrow arrow-slit windows.
"Of course, however loyal a Lopar, it cannot match Damani."
No affection touched Suroth's voice now.
"Pura and Jinjin could slay 100 assassins before Al-Mandaragal blinked his eye."
At the mention of each name, one of the blue-clad women twitched her silvery leash, and the woman at the other end doubled herself as the one in the corridor had.
"We have many more Damani since returning than before. This is a rich hunting ground for Marath Damani. Pura, she added casually, was once a woman of the White Tower. Morgaze's knees wobbled. Aes Sedai? She studied the bent back of the woman called Pura, refusing to believe. No Aes Sedai could be made to cringe like that. But any woman who could channel, not just an Aes Sedai, should be able to take that leash and strangle her tormentor. Anyone at all should be able to. No, this Pura could not be. Morgaze wondered if she dared ask for a chair. That is very interesting. At least her voice was steady. But I do not think you asked me here to speak of Aes Sedai. Of course she had not been asked. Suroth stared at her, not a muscle moving except that the long-nailed fingers of her left hand twitched. Thera! The sharp-faced woman with half her head shaved barked suddenly. Calf for the High Lady and her guest! One of the women in diaphanous robes, the eldest but still young, leaped gracefully to her feet. Her rosebud mouth had a petulant look to it, but she darted behind the tall screen painted with the eagle, and in moments reappeared bearing a silver tray with two small white cups. Kneeling sinuously before Suroth, she bowed her dark head as she raised the tray, so her offering stood higher than she. Morgaze shook her head. Any servant in Andor asked to do that, or wear that robe, would have stormed off in a dudgeon. "Who are you? Where do you come from?" Suroth raised one of the cups on her fingertips, inhaling the steam rising from it. Her nod was entirely too much permission for Morgaze's liking, but she took a cup anyway. One sip and she stared into her drink in amazement. Blacker than any tea, the liquid was also more bitter. No amount of honey would make it drinkable. Suroth put her own cup to her lips and sighed with enjoyment.
There are many things we must speak of, Morgaze, yet I will be brief at this first talk. We Shan-Shan return to reclaim what was stolen from the heirs of the High King, Artur Pendrag Tanreal.
Pleasure over the calf became a different pleasure in her voice, both expectation and certainty, and she watched Morgaze's face closely. Morgaze could not take her eyes away.
What was ours will be ours again. In truth, it always has been. A thief gains no ownership. I have begun the recovery in Tarabon. Many nobles of that land have already sworn to obey, await, and serve. It will not be long before all have. Their king, I cannot recall his name, died opposing me. Had he lived in rebellion against the Crystal Throne, and not even of the blood, he would have been impaled. His family could not be found to be made property, but there is a new king and a new Panarch, who have sworn their fealty to the Empress, may she live forever, and the Crystal Throne. The bandits will be eradicated. No longer will there be strife or hunger in Tarabon, but the people will shelter beneath the wings of the Empress. Now I begin in this Amadicia. Soon all will kneel to the Empress, may she live forever, the direct descendant of the great Artur Hawkwing.
If the serving woman had not gone with the tray, Morgaze would have put her cup back. No tremor disturbed the dark surface of the calf, but much of what the woman spouted was meaningless to her. Empress? Shan-Shan? There had been wild rumors a year or more ago about Artur Hawkwing's armies come back from across the Arath Ocean, but only the most credulous could have believed, and she doubted that the worst gossip-monger in the market still told the tale. Could it have been truth? In any case, what she did understand was more than enough. All honor the name of Artur Hawkwing Suroth. The sharp-faced woman opened her mouth angrily, subsiding at the move of a blue-nailed finger by the High Lady. But his time is long past. Every nation here has an ancient lineage. No land will surrender to you or your empress. If you have taken some part of Tarabon, Suroth's indrawn breath hissed, and her eyes glittered, remember that it is a troubled land, divided against itself. Amadicia will not fall easily, and many nations will ride to her aid when they learn of you. Could it be true? However many you are, you will find no easy game for your spit. We have faced great threats before and overcome them. I advise you to make peace before you are crushed. Morghese remembered Sidar raging in the night, and avoided looking at the Damani, had she called them. By strong effort she managed not to wet her lips. Suroth smiled that masked smile again, eyes shining like polished stones. All must make choices. Some will choose to obey, await, and serve, and will rule their lands in the name of the Empress, may she live forever. She took a hand from her cup to gesture, a slight movement of long fingernails, and the sharp-faced woman barked, "Thera! Poses of the Swan!" For some reason, Suroth's mouth tightened. "Not the Swan, Alwyn, you blind fool," she hissed, half under her breath, though her accent made understanding difficult. The frozen smile returned in an instant. The serving woman rose from her place at the wall again, running out to the middle of the floor in an odd way, on tiptoe, with her arms swept back. Slowly, atop the flaring golden sun, symbol of the Children of the Light, she began a sort of stylized dance. Her arms unfolded to the sides like wings, then folded back. Twisting, she slid her left foot out, lowering herself over the bending knee, both arms outstretched as if appealing, until arms and body and right leg made a straight slanted line. Her sheer white robe made the whole thing scandalous. Morghese felt her cheeks growing hot as the dance, if it could be called that, continued.
"Thera's new and not well trained yet," Suroth murmured. "The poses are most often done with 10 or 20 dacovale together, men and women chosen for the clean beauty of their lines, but sometimes it is pleasant to view only one. It is very pleasant to own beautiful things, is it not?"
Morghese frowned. How could anyone own a person? Suroth had spoken earlier about making someone property. She knew the old tongue, and the word dacovale was not familiar to her, but thinking it out she came up with person who is owned. It was disgusting, horrendous.
"Incredible," she said dryly. "Perhaps I should leave you to enjoy the dance."
"In one moment," Suroth said, smiling at the posturing Thera. Morghese avoided looking.
"I'll have choices to make, as I said. The old king of Tarabon chose to rebel and died. The old Panarch was captured, yet refused the oath. Each of us has a place where we belong, unless raised by the Empress. But those who reject their proper place can also be cast down, even to the depths. Thera has a certain grace. Strangely, Alwyn shows great promise in teaching, so I expect that before many years Thera will learn the skill in the poses to go with her grace."
That smile swiveled toward Morghese. That glittering gaze. A very significant gaze, but why? Something to do with the dancer? Her name, mentioned so often, as if to highlight it. But what? Morghese's head whipped around, and she stared at the woman, up on her toes and slowly pivoting in one spot, with her hands flat together and arms stretched up as high as they would go.
"I don't believe it," she gasped. "I won't."
"Thera," Suroth said. "What was your name before you became my property? What title did you hold?" Thera froze in her upstretched posture, quivering, shooting a look half panic, half terror at sharp-faced Alwyn, a look of pure terror at Suroth.
"Thera was called Amathera, if it pleases the High Lady," she said breathily. "Thera was the Panarch of Tarabon, if it pleases the High Lady."
The cup dropped from Morghese's hand, smashing to bits on the floor, spraying the black calf. It had to be a lie. She had never met Amathera, but she had heard a description once. No. Many women of the right age could have large, dark eyes and a petulant mouth. Pura had never been Aes Sedai, and this woman... "Pose!" Alwyn snapped, and Thera flowed on without so much as one more glance at Suroth or anyone. Whoever she was, clearly the foremost thought in her head now was an urgent desire not to make a mistake. Morghese concentrated on not vomiting. Suroth stepped very close, face cold as midwinter. "All confront choices," she said quietly. Her voice could have marked steel. Some of my prisoners say that you spent time in the White Tower. By law, no Marath Dermani may escape the leash, but I pledge to you that you, who named me to my eyes and called lie on my word, you will not face that fate. The emphasis made quite clear that her pledge covered no other possible fate. The smile that never reached her eyes returned. I hope that you will choose to swear the oath, Morghese, and rule Landor in the name of the Empress. May she live forever. For the first time, Morghese was absolutely certain the woman lied. I will speak to you again tomorrow, or perhaps the next day, if I have time. Turning away, Suroth glided past the lone dancer to the high-backed chair. As she sat, spreading her robe gracefully, Alwyn barked again. She did not seem to have any other voice. All! Poses of the swan! The young men and women kneeling against the wall leaped forward to join Thera, joining her movements exactly in a line before Suroth's chair. Only the Lopar's gaze still acknowledged Morghese's existence. She did not believe she had ever been dismissed so thoroughly in her life. Gathering her dignity with her skirts, she left. She did not go far alone, of course. Those red and black armored soldiers stood in the anteroom like statues with red and black tasseled spears, faces impassive in their lacquered helmets, hard eyes seeming to stare from behind the mandibles of monstrous insects. One, not much taller than she, fell in at her shoulder without a word, and escorted her back to her rooms, where two Taraboners with swords flanked her door, these in steel breastplates, but still painted in horizontal stripes. They bowed low, hands on their knees, and she thought it was for her, until her escort spoke for the first time. "Honor met," he said in a harsh, dry voice, and the Taraboners straightened, never glancing at her until he said, "Watch her well. She has not given the oath." Dark eyes flickered toward her above steel veils, but their short bows of assent were for the Shan-Chan. She tried not to hurry inside, but once the door was closed behind her, she leaned against it, attempting to settle her whirling thoughts. Shan-Chan and Damani, empresses and oaths and people owned. Linny and Brianna stood in the middle of the room, looking at her. "What did you learn?" Linny asked patiently, in much the tone in which she had questioned the child Morghese about a book read. "Nightmares and madness," Morghese sighed. Suddenly she stood up straight, looking around the room anxiously. "Where are the men?" Brianna answered the unasked question in a dryly mocking tone. "Talonvor went to see what he could find out." Her fists planted themselves on her hips, and her face became deadly serious. "Lamgren went with him, and Master Gil. What did you find out? Who are these... Shan-Chan?" She said the name awkwardly, frowning around it. "We heard that much for ourselves." She affected not to notice Linny's biting stare. "What are we to do now, Morghese?" Morghese brushed between the women, crossing to the nearest window. Not as narrow as those in the audience chamber, it looked down 20 feet or more to the stone paving of the courtyard. A dispirited column of bare-headed, disheveled men, some with blood-stained bandages, shambled across the courtyard, under the watchful gaze of Taraboners carrying spears. Several Shan-Chan stood atop a nearby tower, peering into the distance between the crenellations. One wore a helmet decorated with 3 slender plumes. A woman appeared in a window across the court, the lightning-embroidered red panel plain on her breast, frowning down at the white-cloaked prisoners. Those stumbling men looked stunned, unable to believe what had happened. What were they to do? A decision Morghese dreaded. It seemed that she had not made so much as a decision on fruit for breakfast in months, without it leading to disaster. A choice, Suroth had said. Aid these Shan-Chan in taking Andor, or... one last service she could do for Andor. The tail end of the column appeared, followed by more Taraboners, who were joined by their countrymen they passed. A 20-foot fall, and Suroth lost her lever. Maybe it was the coward's way out, but she had already proved herself that. Still, the Queen of Andor should not die so. Under her breath she spoke the irrevocable words that had been used only twice before in the thousand-year history of Andor. "Under the light, I relinquish the high seat of House Trakand to Elaine Trakand. Under the light, I renounce the rose crown and abdicate the lion throne to Elaine, high seat of House Trakand. Under the light, I submit myself to the will of Elaine of Andor, her obedient subject." None of that made Elaine queen, true, but it cleared the way. "What are you smiling at?" Linny asked. Morgay's turned slowly. "I was thinking of Elaine." She did not think her old nurse had been close enough to hear what no one really needed to. Linny's eyes widened, though, and her breath caught. "You come away from there now!" she snapped, and, suiting actions to words, seized her arm and physically pulled her from the window. "Linny, you forget yourself! You stopped being my nurse a long—" Morgaze drew a deep breath and softened her tone. Meeting those frightened eyes was not easy. Nothing frightened Linny. "What I do is for the best, believe me," she told her gently. "There's no other way—" "No other way!" Brianna broke in angrily, gripping her skirts till her hands shook. Clearly she would rather have had them wrapped around Morgaze's throat. "What fool nonsense are you spouting now? What if these Shan-Chan think we killed you?" Morgaze compressed her lips. Had she become so transparent? "Shut up, woman!" Linny never got angry either, or raised her voice, but she did both now, her withered cheeks red. She raised a bony hand. "You hold your mouth, or I'll slap you sillier than you are." "Slap her if you want to slap someone," Brianna shouted back so fiercely that spittle flew. "Queen Morgaze? She will send you and me and my Lamguin to the gallows, and her precious Talonvor, too, because she lacks the belly of a mouse." The door opened to admit Talonvor, and put an abrupt end to it. No one was about to shout in front of him. Linny pretended to examine Morgaze's sleeve, as though it might need mending, as Master Gil and Lamguin followed Talonvor in. Brianna put on a bright smile and smoothed her skirts. The men noticed nothing, of course. Morgaze noticed a great deal. For one thing, Talonvor had a sword belted on, and so did Master Gil, and even Lamguin, though his was a short sword. She'd always had the feeling he was more comfortable with his fists than any other weapons. Before she could ask how, the skinny little man who brought up the rear closed the door carefully behind him. "Majesty," Sebon Balwer said, "forgive the intrusion." Even his bow and his smile seemed dry and precise, but as his eyes flicked from her to the other women, Morgaze decided that whether the other men noticed the atmosphere in the room or not, Pedro Niles, one-time secretary, did. "I am surprised to see you, Master Balwer," she said. "I heard there was some unpleasantness with Aemon Valda." What she had heard was that Valda had said if he laid eyes on Balwer, he would kick him over one of the fortress walls. Balwer's smile tightened. He knew what Valda had said. "He has a plan to take us all out of here," Talonvor broke in. "Today. Now." He gave her a look not that of subject to queen. "We are accepting his offer." "How?" she said slowly, forcing her legs to remain straight. What help could this prissy little stick of a man offer? Escape. She wanted very much to sit down, but she was not going to. Not with Talonvor looking at her in that fashion. Of course she was not his queen now, but he did not know that. Another question occurred. "Why?" "Master Balwer, I'll not shun any true offer of help, but why would you risk yourself? These Shan-Chan will make you regret it should they find out." "I laid my plans before they came," he said carefully. It seemed imprudent to leave the Queen of Andor in Valda's hands. "Consider it my way of repaying him." "I know I am not much to look at, Majesty," he hid a self-deprecating cough behind his hand. "But the plan will work. These Shan-Chan actually make it easier. I would not have been ready for days yet without them. For a newly conquered city, they allow remarkable freedom to anyone willing to say their oath. Not an hour after sunrise, I obtained a pass allowing myself and up to 10 more who have taken the oath to depart Amador. They believe I intend to buy wine and wagons to carry it in the east. It must be a trap. The words tasted bitter. Better the window than falling into some snare. They won't allow you to carry word of them ahead of their army. Balwer's head tilted to one side, and he began dry-washing his hands, then stopped abruptly. In truth, Majesty, I considered that. The officer who gave me the pass said it did not matter. His exact words, "Tell who you will what you have seen, and let them know they cannot stand against us. Your lands will know soon enough anyway." I have seen several merchants take the oath this morning and depart with their wagons. Talonvor moved close to her, too close. She could almost feel his breath, she could feel his eyes. "We are accepting his offer," he said, for her ears alone. "If I must bind and gag you, I think he can find a way even so. He seems a very resourceful little fellow." She met him stare for stare. The window, or a chance. If Talonvor had only held his tongue, it would have been much easier to say, "I accept with gratitude, Master Balwer," but she said it. She stepped away as if to see Balwer without having to crane past Talonvor. It was always disturbing being so near to him. He was too young. "What is to do first? I doubt those guards at the door will accept your pass for us." Balwer bowed his head as if acknowledging her foresight. "I fear they must meet with accidents, Majesty." Talonvor eased his dagger in its scabbard, and Lamgwyn flexed his hands, like the Lopar flexing its claws. She did not believe it could be so easy. Even after they had packed up what they could carry and the two Taraboners had been stuffed beneath her bed. At the main gates, holding her linen dust cloak close awkwardly because of the bundle on her back, she bowed, hands on her knees the way Balwer had shown her, while he told the guards that they had all sworn to obey, await, and serve. She thought of how to make sure she was not taken alive. It was not until they were actually riding out of Amador, past the last guards, on the horses Balwer had had waiting, that she began to believe. Of course, Balwer probably expected some fine reward for rescuing the Queen of Andor. She had not told anyone that that was done with beyond going back. She knew she had spoken the words, and no one else needed to know. Regretting them was useless. Now she would see what sort of life she could find without a throne, a life far from a man who was much too young and much too disturbing. "Why is your smile so sad?" Linny asked, reining her slab-sided brown mare closer. The animal looked moth-eaten. Morgaze's bay was no better. None of the horses were. The Shan Chan might have been willing to let Balwer go with his pass, but not with decent mounts. "There is a long road ahead yet," Morgaze told her, and thumped her mare into some semblance of a trot after Talonvor.
Chapter 27. To Be Alone. Slipping the haft of his axe through the loop on his belt opposite his quiver, Perrin took his unstrung longbow from the corner, slung his saddlebags over his shoulder, and left the rooms he had shared with Fayil without a backward look. They had been happy there, most of the time. He did not think he would ever be back. Sometimes he wondered whether being happy somewhere with Fayil meant he would never return there. He hoped not. The servants he saw in the palace corridors wore unrelieved black livery. Perhaps Rand had ordered it, and perhaps the servants themselves had simply adopted it. They had been uneasy without livery, as though they did not know where they belonged, and black seemed safe as Rand's color because of the Ashaman. Those who saw Perrin scampered away as fast as they could, not waiting for any bows or curtsies. Fear scent drifted behind them. For once his yellow eyes had nothing to do with anyone being afraid. It might not be safe to loiter near a man at whom the dragon reborn had unleashed his rage so publicly this very morning. Perrin eased the shoulder under his saddlebags. A long while had passed since anyone had been able to pick him up and throw him. Of course, no one had ever used the power to try before. One moment in particular stuck with him. He pushed himself up, holding his shoulder, sliding his back up the square column that had stopped his flight. He thought a few ribs might have cracked. Around the Great Hall of the Sun, a scattering of nobles who had come to appeal one thing or another to Rand, tried to look anywhere else, tried to pretend they were anywhere else. Only Dobrain watched, shaking his gray head as Rand stalked across the throne room.
"I will deal with the Aes Sedai as I choose," Rand shouted. "Do you hear me, Perrin? As I choose."
"You've just handed them over to the Wise Ones," he growled back, shoving away from the column. "You don't know whether they're sleeping on silk or had their throats cut. You are not the Creator." With a snarl of rage, Rand threw his head back.
"I am the Dragon Reborn," he cried. "I don't care how they're treated. They deserve a dungeon."
Perrin's hackles stirred as Rand's eyes lowered from the vaulted ceiling. Blue ice would have been warm and soft beside them, the more so because they stared from a face twisted with pain.
"Get out of my sight, Perrin! Do you hear me? Get out of Kyrian! Today! Now! I never want to see you again!"
Pivoting on his heel, he strode away with nobles all but throwing themselves to the floor as he passed. Perrin thumbed a trickle of blood from the corner of his mouth. For one moment there, he had been sure Rand was going to kill him. Shaking his head to rid himself of the thought, he rounded a corner and nearly ran into Loyal. With a large bundle strapped to his back and a scrip big enough to hold a sheep slung on his shoulder, the Ogier was using his long-handled axe as a walking staff. The capacious pockets of his coat bulged with the shapes of books. Loyal's tufted ears perked up at the sight of him, then suddenly drooped. His whole face drooped, eyebrows hanging on his cheeks.
"I heard, Perrin," he boomed sadly. "Rand should not have done that. Quick words make long troubles. I know he'll reconsider. Tomorrow, maybe."
"It's all right," Perrin told him. "Kyrian is too polished for me anyway. I'm a blacksmith, not a courtier. By tomorrow, I'll be a long way gone."
"You and Fael could come with me. Carldin and I are going to visit the Steading, Perrin. All of them, about the Waygates."
A narrow-faced, pale-haired young fellow, standing behind Loyal, stopped frowning at Perrin to frown at the Ogier. He had a scrip and a bundle, too, and a sword on his hip. Despite the blue coat, Perrin recognized one of the Ashaman. Carldin did not look pleased to recognize Perrin. Besides, his smell was cold and angry. Loyal peered down the hallway behind Perrin.
"Where is Fael?"
"She's meeting me in the stables. We had words." That was simple truth. Fael seemed to like shouting sometimes. He lowered his voice. "Loyal, I wouldn't talk about that where anyone could hear. The Waygates, I mean." Loyal snorted hard enough to make a bull jump, but he did drop his tone.
"I don't see anyone but us," he rumbled.
No one more than two or three paces beyond Carldin could have heard clearly. His ears, lashed was the only word, and laid back angrily.
"Everyone's afraid to be seen near you. After all you've done for Rand."
Carldin tugged at Loyal's sleeve. "We have to go," he said, glaring at Perrin. Anyone the Dragon Reborn shouted at was outside the gates, so far as he was concerned. Perrin wondered whether he was holding the power right then.
"Yes, yes,"
Loyal murmured, waving a ham-sized hand, but he leaned on his axe, frowning pensively.
"I don't like this, Perrin. Rand chases you away. He sends me off. How am I to finish my book?"
His ears twitched and he coughed.
"Well, that's neither here nor there. But you, me, and the light only knows where Matt is. He'll send Min away next. He hid from her this morning. He sent me out to tell her he wasn't there. I think she knew I was lying. He'll be alone then, Perrin. It's terrible to be alone. That's what he said to me. He is planning to send all of his friends away."
"The wheel weaves as the wheel wills," Perrin said. Loyal blinked at that echo of Moraine. Perrin had been thinking of her a lot recently. She had been a restraining influence on Rand. Farewell, Loyal. Keep safe. And don't trust anyone you don't have to. He did not quite look at Carlden.
You don't mean that, Perrin.
Loyal sounded shocked. He seemed to trust everyone.
You cannot. Come with me, you and Fael.
We'll meet again one day, Perrin told him gently, and hurried past before he had to say more. He did not like lying, especially not to a friend. In the North Stable, things were much the same as inside the palace. Grooms saw him walk in and dropped dung forks and curry combs, crowding out through small doors at the back. Rustles in the loft high above that might have escaped another's ears told of folk hiding there. He could hear anxious, fearful breaths. He brought Stepper out of a green-streaked marble stall, slipped on his bridle, and tied the dun stallion to a gilded hitching ring. He went to fetch blanket and saddle from a marble tack room, where half the saddles were mounted with silver or gold. The stable fit very well in a palace, with tall square marble columns and a marble floor, even under the straw in the stalls. He rode out, glad to see the back of grandeur. North of the city, he followed the road he had come down so desperately with Rand just a few days before. Rode until folds in the land hid Kyrian. Then he turned off to the east, where a fair patch of forest remained, running down one tall hill and over the next taller one. Just inside the trees, Fael booted Swallow to meet him, Aram heeling her like a hound on his own horse. Aram's face brightened at the sight of him, though that was not saying much. He merely divided his faithful hound looks between him and Fael.
"Husband," she said, not too coolly, but razor-sharp anger and spiky jealousy still threaded through the clean scent of her and her herbal soap.
She was garbed for travel, with a thin dust cloak hanging down her back, and red gloves that matched the boots peeking out beneath the dark, narrow riding skirts she favored. No fewer than 4 sheathed daggers were tucked behind her belt. Movement behind her turned into Bane and Chiad, and Sulin, with a dozen more maidens. Perrin's eyebrows rose. He wondered what Gaul thought of that. The Aielman had said he was looking forward to getting Bane and Chiad alone. Even more surprising were Fael's other companions. "What are they doing here?" He nodded toward a small cluster who held their horses back. He recognized Salanda and Kamael, and the tall Tyran woman, all still in men's clothes and wearing swords. The blocky fellow in a fat-sleeved coat, who had kept his beard oiled and trimmed to a point despite wearing his hair tied back with a ribbon, also looked familiar. The other two men, both Kyrianen, he did not know, but he could guess, by their youth and the ribbon tying their hair, if nothing else, that they were part of Salanda's society.
"I took Salanda and a few of her friends into my service."
Fael spoke lightly, but suddenly she gave off foggy waves of caution.
"They would have gotten themselves into trouble in the city sooner or later. They need someone to give them direction. Think of them as charity. I won't let them get under your feet."
Perrin sighed and scratched his beard. A wise man did not tell his wife to her face that she was hiding things, especially when that wife was Fael. She was going to be as formidable as her mother, if she was not already.
Under his feet? How many of these puppies had she taken on?
"Is everything ready? Pretty soon some idiot back there will decide he can curry favor by bringing Rand my head. I'd like to be gone before that." Aram growled in his throat.
"No one is going to take your head, husband."
Fael showed white teeth and went on in a whisper she knew he would catch.
"Except perhaps me."
In a normal voice, she said,
"All is ready."
In a clear, fairly flat hollow beyond the trees, the two riversmen stood beside their horses, a column of twos that wound out of sight around the side of the hill. Perrin sighed again. The red wolfhead banner and the red eagle of Manetherin stirred slightly in a hot breeze at the head of the column. Maybe another dozen maidens squatted on their heels near the banners. On the other side, Gaul wore as close to a sullen expression as Perrin had ever seen on an Aiel.
As he dismounted, two black-coated men came to him, saluting with fist pressed to heart.
"Lord Perrin," Jerk Rady said, "we've been here since last night. We are ready."
Grady's weathered farmer's face made Perrin almost comfortable with him. But Fagin Neild was another matter. Maybe 10 years younger than Grady, he might have been a farmer too, for all Perrin knew, but he affected airs and graces and wore his pitiful mustache, waxed to a semblance of points. Where Grady was one of the dedicated, he was a soldier, without the silver sword pinned to his collar, but that did not hold him back from speaking.
"Lord Perrin, is it really necessary to take those women with us? There'll be nothing but trouble. They will. The whole lot of them, and you know it well."
Some of the women he was talking about stood not far from the Two Rivers men, shawls looped over their arms. Adara appeared the eldest of the six wise ones, impassively watching the two women Neild had nodded to. In truth, that pair worried Perrin as well. Sionid Trigon, all coolness and reserve in green silk, had been haughtily trying to ignore the Aiel women. Most Kyrianen, who were not pretending to be Aiel, despised them. But when she saw Perrin, she shifted her bay's reins to the other hand and gave Masuri Sakawa a nudge in the ribs. Masuri started. Browns seemed to go off in daydreams fairly often. Stared at the green sister blankly, then directed her stare at Perrin. This one was more the sort she might have given some peculiar and perhaps dangerous animal, one she intended to be sure of before she was done. They had sworn to obey Randall Thor, but how would they do obeying Perrin Ebarra? Giving orders to Aes Sedai seemed unnatural, but better than the other way around, at least.
"Everybody comes," Perrin said. "Let's be gone before we are seen."
Fael sniffed. Grady and Neild saluted again, and strode out to the middle of the treeless area. Perrin had no idea which of them did what was necessary, but suddenly the now familiar silvery vertical flash in the air rotated into a gateway, not quite tall enough to ride through. Trees showed beyond the opening, not that much different from those on the surrounding hills. Grady strode through immediately, but even so he was nearly knocked down by Sulin and a small horde of veiled maidens. They seemed to have taken the honor of being first through a gateway for themselves, and were not about to let anyone usurp it. Foreseeing 100 problems he had not thought of, Perrin led Stepper through into a land not so hilly. There was no clearing, but it was not so thickly treed as the hollow back in Kyrian, either. The scattered trees were taller, but just as sere, even the pines. He did not recognize much else except for oak and leatherleaf. The air seemed a little hotter. Fael followed him, but when he turned to the left, she took Swallow right. Aram's head swung worriedly between them until Perrin nodded toward his wife. The one-time tinker hauled his gelding after her, but quick as he was not before Bane and Chiad, still veiled, and, for all Perrin's orders that the Two Rivers men were to be next, Salanda and a good 2 dozen young Kyrianen and Tyrans poured out of the gateway drawing their horses along. 2 dozen. Shaking his head, Perrin stepped beside Grady, who turned this way and that, studying the sparse woodland. Gaul came stalking up as Danil finally began leading the Two Rivers men out at a run, pulling their horses.
Those bloody banners appeared right behind Danil, going up as soon as they were clear. The man ought to shave those fool mustaches.
"Women are beyond any belief," Gaul muttered.
Perrin opened his mouth to defend Fael before he realized it must be Bane and Chiad the man was glaring at. To cover, he said,
"Do you have a wife, Grady?"
"Sora,"
Grady answered absently, his attention still on the surrounding trees. Perrin would have wagered he held the power now, for sure. Anyone could see a long way in this, compared to any woods back home, but someone could still sneak up on you.
"She's missing me," Grady went on, almost to himself. "You learn to recognize that one right off. I wish I knew why her knee hurts, though."
"Her knee hurts," Perrin said flatly. "Right this minute it hurts."
Grady seemed to realize he was staring, and Gaul was too. He blinked, but went right back to his study.
"Forgive me, Lord Perrin. I need to keep a watch."
For a long moment he said nothing, then began slowly.
"It's something a feller named Candler worked out. The Mihail doesn't like us trying to figure out things on our own, but once it was done..."
His slight grimace said perhaps Taim had not been all that easy about it even then.
"We think maybe it's something like the bond between warders and Aes Sedai. Maybe one in three of us is married. Anyway, that's how many wives stayed instead of running off when they learned what their husbands were. This way, when you're apart from her, you know she's all right and she knows you are. A man likes to know his wife's safe."
"That he does," Perrin said. What was Fahil up to with those fools? She was mounted on Swallow now, and they were all standing close around looking up at her. He would not put it past her to leap into this Giatone nonsense herself. Sionid and Masuri glided behind the last of the Two Rivers men with the three warders they had between them, and the Wise Ones right behind them, which was no surprise. They were along to keep an eye on the Aes Sedai. Sionid gathered her reins as if to mount, but Idara said something in a low voice, pointing to a fat, lopsided oak, and the two Aes Sedai looked at her, heads swiveling as one, then exchanged glances and led their horses to the tree. Matters would go a deal smoother if that pair was always so meek. Well, not meek exactly. Sionid's neck was stiff as a rod. After that came the remounts, a herd of spare horses tied 10 to a lead, under the watchful eyes of folk from Dobrain's estates, who supposedly knew what they were about. Perrin automatically picked out Steyr, on a lead by himself. The woman taking care of him better know what she was doing. A great many high-wheeled supply carts came through, drivers tugging the horses and shouting as if they feared the gateway might close on them. A great many because carts could not carry as much as wagons, and carts because a wagon and team would not fit through the gateway. It seemed neither Niald nor Grady could make one as big as Rand could, or Dashiva. When the last cart finally trundled out on a squealing axle, Perrin considered ordering the gateway closed right then, but Niald was the man holding the thing open, and him on the other side of it back in Kyrian. A moment later, it was too late. Berylaine strode through, leading a mare as white as Swallow was black, and he offered up small thanks that her gray riding dress had a neck right to her chin. On the other hand, from the waist up, it fit as snugly as any Terrabanner dress. Perrin groaned. With her came Norella and Bertain Galena, the lord captain of her winged guards, a gray-haired fellow who wore his black eye patch as another man might a plume in his hat. And then the red-armored winged guards themselves, more than 900 of them. Norella and the rest who had been at Dumai's Wells wore a yellow cord tied high in the left arm. Climbing onto her mare, Berylaine rode off to one side with Galena, while Norella formed the winged guards among the trees. There must have been 50 paces between her and Fahil, and dozens of trees, but she placed herself where they could stare at each other. Stare with so little expression that Perrin's skin crawled. Putting Berylaine at the rear, as far from Fahil as he could manage, had seemed a good notion, but he was going to face this every bloody evening. Burn Rand. Now Niald popped out of the gateway, stroking his ridiculous mustache and preening for anyone who might be watching as the opening vanished. No one was, and he climbed onto his horse with a disgruntled expression. Mounting stepper, Perrin rode to a slight rise. Not everyone could see him because of the trees, but it was enough they could hear. A stir ran through the assemblage as he reined in, people shifting for a better look. "As far as anyone's eyes and ears back in Kyrian know," he said loudly, "I've been banished. The first of Mayen is on her way back home, and the rest of you have just disappeared like fog in the sun." To his surprise, they laughed. A cry of Perrin Golden Eyes went up, and not just from the Two Rivers folk. He waited for it to quiet. That took a while. Fahil neither laughed nor shouted, nor did Berylaine. Each woman shook her head. Neither believed he should tell as much as he intended to. Then they saw each other, and those shaking heads froze as if trapped in amber. They did not like agreeing. It was no surprise when their eyes swung to him with identical expressions. There was an old saying in the Two Rivers, though how you said it and what you meant depended on circumstance and who you were. It's always a man's fault. One thing he had learned women were better at than anything else, teaching a man to sigh. Some of you may be wondering where we are and why, he went on when silence fell at last. A smaller ripple of laughter. This is Gialdan. Murmurs of awe and maybe disbelief at having crossed 1,500 miles or more in a steppe. The first thing we have to do is convince Queen Aleandra we aren't here to invade. Berlane was supposed to talk to Aleandra, and Fail was going to give him fits for it. Then we're going to find a fellow who calls himself the Prophet of the Lord Dragon. That would not be much pleasure either. Massima had been no joy before he tipped over the edge. This prophet has been causing some problems, but we're going to let him know Randall Thor doesn't want anybody frightened into following him, and we'll take him and any of his people who want to come back to the Lord Dragon. And we'll frighten the britches off Massima to do it if need be, he thought wryly. They cheered. They whooped and shouted that they would march this prophet back to Carrion for the Lord Dragon, till Perrin hoped this spot was even farther from any village than it was supposed to be. Even the cart drivers and horse handlers joined in. More than that, he prayed that everything went smoothly and quickly. The sooner he could put as much distance as possible between Berlane and himself and Fail, the better. No surprises. That was what he wanted once they rode south. It was about time his being Tavirin showed itself good for something. Chapter 28 Bread and Cheese. Matt knew he was in trouble from the day he moved into the Tarasin Palace. He could have refused. Just because the flaming dice started or stopped did not mean he had to do anything. Usually when they stopped spinning, it was too late not to do something. The problem was, he wanted to know why. Before very many days, he wished he had taken his curiosity by the throat and throttled it. After Nynaeve and Elaine left his room, once he could manage to reach his feet without his head falling off, he spread the word among his men. Nobody seemed to see the disadvantages. He just wanted to prepare them, but nobody listened.
"Very good, my lord," Nerim murmured, tucking Matt's boot onto his foot. "My lord will finally have decent rooms. Oh, very good!"
For a moment he seemed to lose his mournful expression. For just a moment.
"I will brush the red silk coat for my lord. My lord has stained the blue rather badly with wine."
Matt waited impatiently, put on the coat, and headed down the hall.
"Aes Sedai,"
Elysian muttered as his head popped out at the top of a clean shirt. His round-bellied manservant, Lopin, was hovering behind him.
"Burn my soul, I don't much like Aes Sedai, but the Tarasin Palace, Matt."
Matt winced. Bad enough the man could drink a barrel of brandy with no effect the next morning, but did he have to grin so?
"Ah, Matt, now we can forget dice and play cards with our own kind."
He meant nobles, the only ones who could afford to play, except for well-to-do merchants, who would not remain well-to-do long if they began betting for the stakes nobles did. Nalesian rubbed his hands briskly while Lopin tried to settle his laces. Even his beard seemed eager.
"Silk sheets," he murmured.
Whoever heard of silk sheets? Those old memories nudged, but Matt refused to listen.
"Full of nobles," Vannin growled downstairs,
pursing his lips to spit. His glance searching for Mistress Annan was automatic now. He decided instead to swallow from the mug of rough wine that was his breakfast.
"Be good to see the Lady Elaine again, though," he mused.
His free hand rose as if to knuckle his forehead. He did not seem aware of the gesture. Matt groaned. That woman had ruined a good man.
"You want me to look in on Carradine again?" Vannin went on, as if the rest was unimportant. "His street's so full of beggars, it's hard to see anything. But he has an awful lot of folk come to call."
Matt told him that would be fine.
No wonder Vannin did not care whether the palace was full of nobles and Aes Sedai. He would spend the day sweating in the sun and jostled by the crowds. Much more comfortable. There was no point trying to warn Harnin and the rest of the Red Arms, all shoveling down white porridge and tiny black sausages, while they nudged one another in the ribs and laughed about the serving women in the palace, who, they had heard, were all chosen for their beauty and remarkably free with their favors. A true fact, they kept assuring themselves. Things did not get any better when he went into the kitchens searching for Mistress Anan to settle the bill. Kyra was there, but, with all her bad temper of the night before, doubled. She stuck out her lower lip, glowering at him, and stalked out the door to the stable yard, rubbing the back of her skirt. Maybe she had gotten herself into some misery or other, but how she could blame Matt Coffin was beyond him. Mistress Anan was out, it seemed. She was always organizing soup kitchens for refugees or leaping into some other good work, but Enid was waving a long wooden spoon at her scurrying helpers and ready to take his coin in her stout hand. "You squeeze too many melons, my young lord, and you shouldn't be surprised when a rotten one breaks in your hand," she said darkly for some reason. "Or two," she added after a moment, nodding. She leaned close, tilting up her sweating round face with an intense stare.
"You'll only make trouble for yourself if you say a word. You won't."
That did not sound like a question. "Not a word," Matt said. What in the light was she talking about? It seemed the right response, though, because she nodded and waddled away, waving that spoon twice as vigorously as before. For a moment he had thought she meant to thump him with it. The pure truth was, women all had a violent streak, not just some of them. One thing and another, it was a relief when Nerim and Lopin got into a shouting match over whose master's baggage would be carried over first. Smoothing their feathers required a good half an hour from him and Nalisian both. A manservant with his dander ruffled could make your life miserable. Then he had to settle which of the Red Arms were to have the honor of lugging the chest of gold across, and which were to take the horses. Anyway, it was that much longer outside the bloody Tarrasan Palace. Once he was ensconced in his new rooms, though, he almost forgot troubles at first. He had a large sitting room, and a small, what they called a sulking room hereabouts, and an immense bedchamber with the biggest bed he had ever seen, the massive bedposts carved with entwined flowers of all things and painted red. Most of the furniture was bright red or bright blue, where it was not layered with gilt. A small door near the bed led to a cramped room for Nerim, which the fellow seemed to think was excellent despite a narrow bed and no window. Matt's rooms all had tall arched windows letting onto white wrought iron balconies that overlooked the Malhara. The stand lamps were gilded, and so were the mirror frames. There were two mirrors in the sulking room, three in the sitting room, and four in the bedchamber. The clock, a clock, on the marble mantel above the fireplace in the sitting room, sparkled with gilt as well. The wash basin and pitcher were red seafolk porcelain. He was almost disappointed to discover that the chamber pot under the bed was only plain white pottery. There was even a shelf in the large sitting room with a full dozen books. Not that he read much. Even given the jarring colors of walls and ceilings and floor tiles, the rooms shouted rich. Any other time, he would have danced a jig. Any time when he was not aware that a woman with chambers right down the hall wanted to stick him in hot water and put a bellows to the fire. If Teslin or Merlilla or one of that lot did not manage it first, despite his medallion. Why had the dice in his head stopped tumbling as soon as Elaine mentioned these bloody rooms? Curiosity. He had heard a saying on several women's lips back home, usually when he had done something that looked fun at the time. Men teach cats curiosity, but cats keep sense for themselves. "I'm no bloody cat," he muttered, stalking out of the bedchamber into the sitting room. He just had to know. That was all.
"Of course you're not a cat," Tylan said. "You're a succulent little duckling, is what you are."
Matt gave a start and stared. "Duckling? And a little duckling at that.
The woman stood well short of his shoulder. Indignation or no indignation, he managed an elegant bow anyway. She was the queen. He had to remember that.
Majesty, thank you for these wonderful apartments. I'd love to talk with you, but I have to go out and...
Smiling, she advanced across the red and green floor tiles, layered blue and white silk petticoats swishing, large dark eyes fixed on him. He had no desire at all to look at the marriage knife nestled in her generous cleavage, or the larger, gem-studded dagger thrust behind an equally gem-studded belt. He backed away.
"Majesty, I have an important..."
She started humming. He recognized the tune. He had hummed it to a few girls lately. He was wise enough not to try actually singing with his voice, and besides, the words they used in Ebu Dar would have singed his ears. Around here they called it, "I will steal your breath with kisses." Laughing nervously, he tried to put a lapis-inlaid table between them, but she somehow got around it first without seeming to increase her speed.
"Majesty, I..."
She laid a hand flat on his chest, back-heeled him into a high-backed chair, and plumped herself down on his lap. Between her and the chair arms, he was trapped.
Oh, he could have picked her up and set her on her feet quite easily, except that she did have that bloody big dagger in her belt, and he doubted his manhandling her would be as acceptable to her as her manhandling him seemed to be. This was Ebu Dar, after all, where a woman killing a man was justified until proven otherwise. He could have picked her up easily, except...
He had seen fishmongers in the city selling peculiar creatures called squid and octopus. Ebu Dar actually ate the things. But they had nothing on Tylan. The woman possessed 10 hands. He thrashed about, vainly trying to fend her off, and she laughed softly. Between kisses, he breathlessly protested that someone might walk in, and she just chuckled. He babbled his respect for her crown, and she chortled. He claimed betrothal to a girl back home who held his heart in her hands. She really laughed at that.
"What she does not know cannot harm her,"
she murmured, her 20 hands not slowing for an instant. Someone knocked at the door. Prying his mouth free, he shouted, "Who is it?" Well, it was a shout. A high-pitched shout. He was out of breath, after all. Tylan was off his lap and 3 paces away so fast it seemed she was just here, then there. The woman had the nerve to give him a reproachful look. And then she made a kiss at him. That barely left her lips before the door opened and Tom stuck his head in.
"Matt? I wasn't sure that was you." "Oh, Majesty."
For a scrawny old gleeman with pretensions, Tom could flourish a bow with the best in spite of his limp. Julin could not, but he snatched off his ridiculous red hat and did what he could.
"Forgive us. We won't disturb..."
Tom began, but Matt broke in hurriedly.
"Come in, Tom."
Snatching his coat back on all the way, he started to stand, then realized that somehow the bloody woman had untied the waist of his breeches without him noticing. These two might miss that his shirt was undone to his belly, but they would not miss his breeches falling off. Tylan's blue dress was not must at all.
"Julin, come in."
"I am glad you find the rooms acceptable, Master Cawthon," Tylan said, dignity incarnate.
Except for her eyes, anyway, when she stood so Tom and Julin could not see them. Her eyes laced innocuous words with added meaning.
"I look forward to having your company with pleasure. I shall find it interesting, having a Taviran where I can reach out and touch him at will. But I must leave you to your friends now. No, do not stand, please."
That with just the hint of a mocking smile.
"Well, boy," Tom said, knuckling his mustaches when she was gone, "there's luck for you, being welcomed with open arms by the queen herself."
Julin became very interested in his cap. Matt eyed them warily, mentally daring them to say a word more. Just one word. But once he asked after Nynaeve and Elaine, he quit worrying what they suspected. The women were not back. He almost leaped up, breeches or no. They were trying to wiggle out of their agreement already. He had to explain what he meant in between their outbursts of incredulity, in between expressing his opinions of Nynaeve Bloody Almira and Elaine Bloody Daughter Eyre. Not much chance they would have gone off to the Rahad without him, but he would not put it past them to try their hand spying on Caradhran. Elaine would demand a confession and expect the man to break down. Nynaeve would try to beat one out of him. "I doubt they are bothering Caradhran," Julin said, scratching behind his ear. "I believe Avienda and Brigitte are taking a look at him, from what I heard. We didn't see them go. I do not think you need to worry about him knowing what he's seeing, even if he walks right by them." Tom, pouring himself a golden goblet of wine punch that Matt had found waiting, took up the explanation. Matt put a hand over his eyes. "Disguises made with the power. No wonder they had slipped away like snakes whenever they wanted. Those women were going to make trouble. That was what women did best." It hardly surprised him to learn that Tom and Julin knew less about this bowl of winds than he did. After they left to ready themselves for a trip to the Rahad, he had time to set his clothes to rights before Nynaeve and Elaine came back. He had time to check on Alvar in his room one floor down. The boy's skinny frame had fleshed out somewhat, with Enid and the rest of the cooks at the Wandering Woman stuffing him, but he would always be short, even for a Kyrianan. And if his ears shrank to half their size and his mouth to half its width, his nose would still stop him well short of handsome. No fewer than 3 serving women fussed over him while he sat cross-legged on his bed. "Matt, don't you think Hazel has the most beautiful eyes?" Ulver said, beaming at the big-eyed young woman Matt had met the last time he came to the palace. She beamed back and ruffled the boy's hair. "Oh, but Alice and Loya are so sweet, I could never choose." A plump woman just short of her middle years looked up from unpacking Ulver's saddlebags to give him a broad grin, and a slender girl with bee-stung lips patted the towel she had just put on his washstand, then flung herself onto the bed to tickle Ulver's ribs till he fell over laughing helplessly. Matt snorted. Harnan and that lot were bad enough, but now these women were encouraging the boy. How was he ever going to learn to behave if women did that? Ulver ought to be playing in the streets like any other 10-year-old. He had had no serving women falling over him in his rooms. Tylin had seen to that, he was sure. He had time to check on Ulver and to look in on Harnan and the rest of the Red Arms, sharing a long room lined with beds not far from the stables, and to saunter down to the kitchen for some bread and beef. He had not been able to face that porridge back at the inn. Still, Nynaeve and Elaine had not returned. He finally looked over the books in his sitting room and began reading the travels of Jane Farstrider, though he barely made out a word for worrying. Tom and Julin came in, just as the women finally bustled in, exclaiming over finding him there, as if they thought he would not keep his word. He closed the book gently, set it gently on the table beside his chair.
"Where have you been?"
"Why, we went for a walk," Elaine said brightly, blue eyes wider than he remembered seeing before. Tom frowned and produced a knife from his sleeve, rolling it back and forth through his fingers. He very markedly did not so much as glance at Elaine.
"We had some tea with some women your innkeeper knows," Nynaeve said. "I won't bore you with talk about needlework."
Julin started to shake his head, then stopped before she noticed.
"Please, don't bore me," Matt said dryly.
He supposed she knew one end of a needle from the other, but he suspected she would as soon stick one through her tongue as talk about needlework. Neither woman cracked her teeth about civility, confirming his worst suspicions. "I've told off 2 fellows to walk out with each of you this afternoon, and there will be 2 more tomorrow and every day. If you're not inside the palace or under my nose, you'll have bodyguards. They know their turns already. They'll stay with you at all times. All times. And you will let me know where you're headed. No more making me worry till my hair falls out."
He expected indignation and argument. He expected weaseling over what they had or had not promised. He expected that demanding this whole loaf might get him a slice at the end, a butt slice if his luck was in.
Nynaeve looked at Elaine. Elaine looked at Nynaeve.
"Why, bodyguards are a wonderful idea, Matt," Elaine exclaimed, her cheek dimpling in a smile. "I suppose you were right about that. It's very smart of you to have your men all ready to a schedule."
"It is a wonderful notion," Nynaeve said, nodding enthusiastically. "Very smart of you, Matt."
Tom dropped the knife with a muffled curse and sat sucking on a nicked finger, staring at the women.
Matt sighed. Trouble. He had known it. And that was before they had told him to forget the Rahad for the time being. Which was how he found himself on a bench in front of a cheap tavern not far from the riverfront called the Rose of the Elbar, drinking from one of the dented tin cups chained to the bench. At least they washed the cups out for each new patron. The stink from a dyer shop across the way only raised the style of the Rose. Not that it was a shabby neighborhood, really, though the street was too narrow for carriages. A fair number of brightly lacquered sedan chairs swayed through the crowd. If far more passers-by wore wool and perhaps a guild vest than silk, the wool was as often well-cut as frayed. The houses and shops were the usual array of white plaster, and if most were small and even run down, the tall house of a wealthy merchant stood on a corner to his right, and on the left, a diminutive palace, smaller than the merchant's house at least, with a single green-banded dome and no spire. A pair of taverns and an inn in plain sight looked cool and inviting. Unfortunately, the Rose was the only one where a man could sit outside, the only one in just the right spot. Unfortunately. "I doubt I've ever seen such splendid flies," Nalesian grumbled, waving away several choice specimens from his cup. "What is it we're doing again?" "You are swilling that foul excuse for wine and sweating like a goat," Matt muttered, tucking his hat to shade his eyes better. "I am being Taviran." He glared at the dilapidated house between the dyer's and a noisy weaver's establishment that he had been told to watch. Not asked, told. That was what it came to, however they phrased it, squirming around their pledges. Oh, they made it sound like asking, made it sound like pleading at the end, which he would believe when dogs danced, but he knew when he had been bullied. "Just be Taviran, Matt," he mimicked. "I know you'll just know what to do." "Bah!" Maybe Elaine bloody daughter heir and her bloody dimple knew, or Nynaeve with her bloody hands twitching to yank her bloody braid, but he would be burned if he did. "If the pig-kissing bowl is in the Rahad, how am I supposed to find it on this flaming side of the river?" "I do not remember them saying," Julin said wryly, and took a long swallow of some drink made from a yellow fruit grown in the countryside. "You have asked that 50 times, at least." He claimed the pale drink was refreshing in the heat, but Matt had taken a bite of one of those lemons, and he was not about to swallow anything made from them. With his head still throbbing faintly, he himself drank tea. It tasted as if the tavern keeper, a scrawny fellow with beady, suspicious eyes, had been dumping new leaves and water in yesterday's leavings since the founding of the city. The taste suited his mood.
"What interests me," Tom murmured over steepled fingers, "is why they asked so many questions about your innkeeper."
He did not seem very upset at the women still keeping secrets. Sometimes he was decidedly odd.
"What do Sitala Anan and these women have to do with the bowl?"
Women did pass in and out of the dilapidated house. A steady stream of women, just about. Some well-dressed, if none in silks, and not one man. 3 or 4 wore the red belt of a wise woman. Matt had considered following some of them when they left, but it felt too planned. He did not know how Taviran worked. He had never really seen any sign of it in himself. But his luck was always best when everything was random. Like with dice. Most of those little iron tavern puzzles eluded him, however lucky he felt. He ignored Tom's question. Tom had asked it at least as often as Matt had asked how he was to find the bowl here. Nynaeve had told him to his face she had not promised to tell him every last thing she knew. She said she would tell him whatever he needed to know. She said. Watching her nearly choke from not calling him names was not nearly enough vengeance.
I suppose I should take a walk down the alley, Nalesian sighed, in case one of those women decides to climb over the garden wall.
The narrow gap between the house and the dyer lay in full view for its whole length. But another alleyway ran along behind the shops and houses.
Matt, tell me again why we're doing this instead of playing cards.
I'll do it, Matt said. Maybe he would find out how Tavirin worked behind the garden wall. He went, and found out nothing. By the time twilight began creeping over the street, and Harnan came with a bald-headed, narrow-eyed Andoran named Watt, the only possible effect of being Tavirin he had seen was that the tavern keeper brewed a fresh pot of tea. It tasted almost as bad as the old. Back in his rooms in the palace, he found a note, an invitation of sorts, elegantly lettered on thick white paper that smelled like a garden of flowers.
My little rabbit, I expect to have you for dinner tonight in my apartments.
No signature. But he hardly needed one. Light, the woman had no shame at all. There was a red-painted iron lock on the door to the corridor. He found the key and locked it. Then, for good measure, he jammed a chair under the latch on the door to Nerim's room. He could do well enough without supper. Just as he was about to climb into bed, the lock rattled. Out in the hall, a woman laughed at finding the door secured. He should have been able to sleep soundly then, but for some reason he lay there listening to his belly grumble. Why was she doing this? Well, he knew why, but why him? Surely she had not decided to toss all decency over the barn just to bed at Tavirin. He was safe now, anyway. Tylin would not batter down the door, after all. Would she? Not even most birds could get in through the wrought-iron arabesques screening the balconies. Besides, she would need a long ladder to reach that high, and men to carry it. Unless she climbed down from the roof on a rope. Or she could... The night passed, his stomach rumbled, the sun rose, and he never closed his eyes or had a decent thought. Except that he did make a decision. He thought of a use for the sulking room. He certainly never sulked. At first light, he sneaked out of his rooms and found another of the palace servants he remembered, a balding fellow named Madik, with a smug, self-satisfied air and a shy twist to his mouth that said he was not satisfied at all. A man who could be bought. Though the startled look that flashed across his square face and the smirk he barely bothered to hide said he knew exactly why Matt was slipping gold into his hand. Blood and ashes! How many people knew what Tylin was up to? Nynaeve and Elaine did not seem to, thank the light. Though that did mean they chided him about missing dinner with the queen, which they had learned about when Tylin inquired whether he was ill. And worse. Please, Elaine said, smiling almost as if the word did not pain her. You must put your best foot forward with the queen. Don't be nervous. You will enjoy an evening with her.
Just don't do anything to offend her, Nynaeve muttered.
There was no doubt with her that being civil hurt. Her brows drew down in concentration, her jaw tightened, and her hands trembled to pull her braid.
Be accommodating for once in your...
I mean to say, remember she's a decent woman, and don't try any of your...
Light, you know what I mean.
Nervous?
Ha!
Decent woman?
Ha!
Neither seemed the least concerned that he had wasted a whole afternoon. Elaine patted his shoulder sympathetically and asked him please to try another day or two. It certainly was better than tramping through the Rahad in this heat. Nynaeve said the exact same thing, the way women did, but without the shoulder pat. They admitted right out that they intended to spend the day trying to spy on Cardin with Avienda, though they evaded his question of who it was they thought they might recognize. Nynaeve let that slip, and Elaine gave her such a look he thought he might see Nynaeve's ears boxed for once. They meekly accepted his stricture not to lose sight of their bodyguards, and meekly let him see the disguises they intended to wear. Even after Tom's description, seeing the pair suddenly turn into Abudari women in front of his eyes was almost as big a shock as their meekness.
Well, Nynaeve made a sickly stab at meekness, growling when she realized he had meant what he said about the Aiel woman needing no bodyguard. But she came close. Either one of these women folding her hands and answering submissively made him nervous. Both of them together, with Avienda nodding approvingly, and he was happy to send them on their way. Just to be sure, though, he ignored their suddenly flat mouths and made them demonstrate their disguises for the men he was sending along first. Vannin leaped at the chance to be one of Elaine's guards, knuckling his forehead right and left like a fool. The fat man had not learned much watching on his own. Just as on the day before, a surprising number of people had come to call on Carradine, including some in silk, but that was not proof they were all dark friends. All said and done, the man was the White Cloak ambassador. More folk who wanted to trade into Amadisia probably went to him than to the Amadisian ambassador, whoever he or she was. Vannin did say two women had definitely been watching Carradine's palace, too. The look on his face when Avienda suddenly turned into a third Abudari woman was a wonder. And also an old man, he thought, though the fellow proved surprisingly spry. Vannin had not managed to get a good look at him despite spotting him three times. Once Vannin and the women left, Matt sent off Tom and Julin to see what they could uncover concerning Jacob Carden and a bent, white-haired old man with an interest in dark friends. If the thief-catcher could not discover a way to trip Carden on his face, it did not exist. And Tom seemed to have a way of putting together all the gossip and rumor in a place and filtering out the truth. All that was the easy part, of course. For 2 days he sweated on that bench, with an occasional stroll down the alley beside the dyers, and the only thing that changed was that the tea got worse again. The wine was so bad, Nalesian began drinking ale. The first day the tavern keeper offered fish for a midday meal, but by the smell, they had been caught last week. The second day, he offered a stew of oysters. Matt ate 5 bowls of that, despite the bits of shell. Brigida declined both. He had been surprised when she caught up to him in Elysian, hurrying across the Mulhara that first morning. The sun barely made a rim above the rooftops, but already people in carts dotted the square. "I must have blinked," she laughed. "I was waiting the way I thought you'd come out. If you don't mind company." "We move fast sometimes," he said evasively. Nalesian looked at him sideways. Of course, he had no idea why they had crept out through a tiny side door near the stables. It was not that Matt thought Tylan would actually leap on him in the halls in broad daylight. But then again, it never hurt to be careful. "Your company is welcome any time. Thanks." She just shrugged and murmured something he did not catch and fell in on the other side of him. That was the beginning with her. Any other woman he had ever known would have demanded to know thanks for what, and then explained why none were necessary at such length that he wanted to cover his ears, or upbraided him at equal length for thinking they were, or sometimes made it clear she expected something more substantial than words. Brigida just shrugged, and over the next 2 days, something startling occurred in his head. Normally, to him, women were to admire and smile at, to dance with and kiss if they would allow, to snuggle with if he was lucky. Deciding which women to chase was almost as fun as chasing them, if not nearly so much as catching them. Some women were just friends, of course. A few. Egwene, for one, though he was not sure how that friendship would survive her becoming Amarlin. Nynaeve was sort of a friend, in a way. If she could forget for 1 hour that she had switched his bottom more than once, and remember he was not a boy anymore. But a woman friend was different from a man. You always knew her mind ran along other paths than yours, that she saw the world with different eyes. Brigida leaned toward him on the bench.
"Best be wary," she murmured. "That widow is looking for a new husband. The sheath on her marriage knife is blue. Besides, the house is over there."
He blinked, losing sight of the sweetly plump woman who rolled her hips so extravagantly as she walked, and Brigida answered his sheepish grin with a laugh. Nynaeve would have flayed him with her tongue for looking, and even Egwene would have been coolly disapproving. By the end of the second day on that bench, he realized he had sat all that time with his hip pressed against Brigitte's, and never once thought of trying to kiss her. He was sure she did not want to be kissed by him. Frankly, considering the dog-ugly men she seemed to enjoy looking at, he might have been insulted if she had. And she was a hero out of legend, whom he still half expected to leap over a house and grab a couple of the Forsaken by the neck on the way. But that was not it. He would as soon have thought of kissing the Lycian. The same as the Tyran, just exactly the same as, he liked Brigitte. 2 days on that bench, up and down to trot down the alley beside the dyer and stare at the tall wall of bare brick at the back of the house's garden. Brigitte could have climbed it, but even she might have broken her neck if she tried wearing a dress. 3 times he decided on the spur of the moment to follow a woman coming out of the house, 2 wearing the red belt of a wise woman. Random chance did seem to invoke his luck. One of the wise women went around the corner and bought a bunch of shriveled turnips before going back. The other walked 2 streets over to buy a pair of big green-striped fish. The third woman, tall and dark in neat gray wool, maybe a Tyran, crossed 2 bridges before entering a large shop, where she was greeted with smiles by a skinny, bowing fellow, and began supervising the loading of lacquered boxes and trays into sawdust-filled baskets that were then loaded into a wagon. By what he heard, she hoped to fetch a pretty piece of silver with them in Andor. Matt barely managed to escape without buying a box. So much for random luck. No one else had any either. Nynaeve and Elaine and Avienda made their pilgrimages to the streets around Carden's small palace without seeing anyone they recognized, which frustrated them no end. They still refused to say who. It hardly mattered, since the people were not to be seen. That was what they said, showing him enough teeth for 6 women. The grimaces were supposed to be smiles, he thought. It was a shame Avienda seemed to have fallen in with the other 2 so thoroughly, but there was a moment when he was pressing them for an answer, and Elaine snapped at him, staring down her nose, and the Aiel woman whispered something in her ear.
It was a shame Avienda seemed to have fallen in with the other 2 so thoroughly, but there was a moment when he was pressing them for an answer, and Elaine snapped at him, staring down her nose, and the Aiel woman whispered something in her ear. "Forgive me, Matt," Elaine said earnestly, her face going so red her hair seemed to pale. "I humbly beg pardon for speaking so. I will beg on my knees, if you wish." No surprise that her voice faltered at the end. "No need for that," he said faintly, trying not to goggle. "You're forgiven. It was nothing." The oddest thing, though, Elaine looked at Avienda the whole time she spoke to him, and did not twitch an eyelid when he replied, but heaved a great sigh of relief when Avienda nodded. Women were just strange. Tom reported that Carden gave to beggars frequently, and aside from that, every scrap of word about him in Ebudar was the kind to be expected, depending on whether the speaker thought white cloaks were murderous monsters or the true saviors of the world. Julin learned that Carden had purchased a plan of the Tarasan Palace, which might indicate some white cloak intention toward Ebudar, and might indicate that Pedro Nile wanted a palace for himself and intended to copy the Tarasan. If he still lived. Rumors had sprung up in the city that he was dead, but then half said Aes Sedai had killed him, and half said Rand had, which showed their worth. Neither Julin or Tom had scuffed up a pebble concerning a white-haired old man with a much-worn face. Frustration with Carden, frustration with watching the bloody house, and as far as the palace went. Matt found out how things were to go that first night when he finally got back to his rooms. Alvar was there, already fed and curled up in a chair with the travels of Jayen Farstrider by the light of the stand lamps, and not at all upset over being moved out of his own room. Madoc had been as good as his word. As good as the gold he stuffed in his pouch, anyway. The sulking room now held Alvar's bed. Just let Tylin try anything with a child watching her.
The queen had not been idle either, though. He sneaked down to the kitchens like a fox, slipping from corner to corner, flashing downstairs, and found there was no food to be had. Oh, the smell of cooking permeated the air. Roasts turning on spits in the big fireplaces, pots bubbling atop the white-tiled stoves, and cooks kept popping open ovens to prod this or that. There was just no food for Matt Cawthon. Smiling women in pristine white aprons ignored his own smiles and put themselves in his way, so he could not get near the sources of those wonderful smells. They smiled and rapped his knuckles when he tried to snatch a loaf of bread or just a bit of honey-glazed turnip. They smiled and told him he must not spoil his appetite if he was to eat with the queen. They knew. Every last one of them knew. His own blushes, as much as anything else, drove him back to his rooms, bitterly regretting that odorous fish at midday. He locked the door behind him. A woman who would starve a man might try anything. He was lying on a green silk carpet playing snakes and foxes with Oliver, when the second note was slipped under his door. "I have been told it is more sporting to take a pigeon on the wing, to watch it flutter. But sooner or later, a hungry bird will fly to the hand." "What is it, Matt?" Oliver asked. "Nothing." Matt crumpled the note. "Another game?" "Oh, yes." The boy would play the fool game all day, given a chance. "Matt, did you try any of that ham they cooked tonight? I never tasted anything—" "Just throw the dice, Oliver. Just throw the bloody dice." Coming back for his third night in the palace, he bought bread and olives and ewe's milk cheese on the way, which was just as well. The kitchen still had its orders. The bloody women actually laughed out loud while they wafted steaming platters of meats and fishes just beyond his reach and told him not to spoil his bloody appetite. He maintained his dignity. He did not grab a platter and run. He made his finest leg, flourishing an imaginary cloak. "Gracious ladies, your warmth and hospitality overwhelm me." His withdrawal would have gone a deal better if one of the cooks had not cackled at his back. "The queen will feast on roast duckling soon enough, lad." Very droll. The other women roared so hard they must have been rolling on the floor. Very bloody droll. Bread and olives and salty cheese made a fine meal, with a little water from his washstand to wash it down. There had not been any wine punch in his room since that first day. Oliver tried to tell him about some sort of roasted fish with mustard sauce and raisins. Matt told him to practice his reading. Nobody slipped a note under his door that night. Nobody rattled the lock. He began to think things might turn for the better. Tomorrow was the festival of birds. From what he had heard of the costumes some people wore, men and women both, it might be possible Tylan would find herself a new duckling to chase after. Somebody might come out of that bloody house across from the Rose of the Elbar and hand him the bloody Bull of the Winds. Things just had to turn for the better. When he woke for his tired third morning in the Tarasin Palace, the dice were rolling in his head. Chapter 29 The Festival of Birds. Waking to the dice, Matt considered going back to sleep until they went away, but at last he got up feeling grumpy. As if he did not have more than enough on his plate already. He chased Narum away and dressed himself, eating the last of the bread and cheese from the night before while he did, then went to check on Oliver. The boy flashed between bursts of yanking on his clothes in a hurry to be out, and stopping entirely with boot or shirt in hand, to spout dozens of questions that Matt answered with half a mind. No, they would not go racing today, and never mind the rich races at the Circuit of Heaven north of the city. Maybe they could go see the menagerie. Yes, Matt would buy him a feathered mask for the festival. If he ever got dressed. That sent him into a flurry. What really occupied Matt's thoughts were those bloody dice. Why had they started up again? He still did not know why they had before. When Oliver was finally clothed, he followed Matt into the sitting room, bubbling with half-heard questions,
and bumped him from behind when he stopped dead. Tylan replaced the book Oliver had been reading the night before on the table.
"Majesty!" Matt's eyes darted to the door he had locked last night, now standing wide open. "What a surprise!"
He pulled Oliver around in front of him, between him and the woman's mocking smile. Well, maybe it was not really mocking, but it surely seemed so right then. She was certainly pleased with herself.
"I was about to take Oliver out, to see the festival, and some traveling menagerie. He wants a feathered mask."
He snapped his mouth shut to stop babbling and started edging toward the door, using the boy as a shield.
"Yes," Tylan murmured, watching through her eyelashes.
She made no move to intervene, but her smile deepened, as if she was just waiting for his foot to land in the snare.
"Much better if he has a companion instead of running with the urchins, as I hear he does. One hears a good deal about your lad. Rosella?"
A woman appeared in the doorway, and Matt gave a start. A fanciful mask of swirling blue and golden feathers hid most of Rosella's face, but the feathers on the rest of her costume did not hide very much else. She possessed the most spectacular bosom he had ever seen.
"Oliver," she said, sinking to her knees, "would you like to walk out with me at festival?"
She held up a mask like a red and green hawk, just the right size for a boy. Before Matt could open his mouth, Oliver broke free and rushed to her.
"Oh, yes, please! Thank you!"
The ungrateful little lout laughed as she tied the hawk mask on his face and hugged him to her bosom. Hand in hand, they ran out, leaving Matt gaping. He recovered himself quickly enough when Tylan said,
"Well for you, I am not a jealous woman, my sweet."
She produced the long iron key to his door from behind her gold and silver belt, and then another just like it, waggling the pair at him.
"People always keep keys in a box near the door."
That was where he had left his.
"And no one ever thinks there might be a second key."
One key went back behind her belt, the other was turned in the lock with a loud click before joining its fellow.
"Now, lambkin,"
she smiled. It was too much. The woman hounded him, tried to starve him. Now she locked them in together like he did not know what.
"Lambkin?"
Those bloody dice were bouncing around in his skull. Besides, he had important business to see to. The dice had never had anything to do with finding something, but... He reached her in two long strides, seized her arm, and began fumbling in her belt for the keys.
"I don't have bloody time for—"
His breath froze as the sharp point of her dagger beneath his chin shut his mouth and drove him right up onto his toes.
"Remove your hand," she said coldly.
He managed to look down his nose at her face. She was not smiling now. He let go of her arm carefully. She did not lessen the pressure of her blade, though. She shook her head.
"I do try to make allowances for you being an outlander, Gosling. But since you wish to play roughly, hands at your sides. Move."
The knife point gave a direction. He shuffled backward on tiptoe rather than have his neck sliced.
"What are you going to do?"
he mumbled through his teeth. A stretched neck put a strain in his voice. A stretched neck, among other things.
"Well?"
He could try grabbing her wrist. He was quick with his hands.
"What are you going to do?"
Quick enough with the knife already at his throat. That was the question. That, and the one he asked her. If she intended to kill him, a shove of her wrist right there would drive the dagger straight up into his brain.
"Will you answer me?"
That was not panic in his voice. He was not in a panic.
"Majesty? Tylan?"
Well, maybe he was in a bit of a panic, to use her name. You could call any woman in Ebudar duckling or pudding all day, and she would smile.
But use her name before she said you could, and you found a hotter reception than you would for goosing a strange woman on the street anywhere else. A few kisses exchanged were never enough for permission either.
Tylan did not answer, only kept him tiptoeing backward until suddenly his shoulders bumped against something that stopped him. With that flaming dagger never easing a hair, he could not move his head, but his eyes that had been focused on her face darted. They were in the bedchamber, a flower-carved red bedpost hard between his shoulder blades. Why would she bring him? His face was suddenly as crimson as the bedpost.
No! She could not mean to... It was not decent. It was not possible. You can't do this to me, he mumbled at her.
And if his voice was a touch breathy and shrill, he surely had cause.
Watch and learn, my kitten, Tylan said, and drew her marriage knife. Afterward, a considerable time later, he irritably pulled the sheet up to his chest. A silk sheet. Nalesian had been right. The Queen of Altara hummed happily beside the bed, arms twisted behind her to do up the buttons of her dress. All he had on was the foxhead medallion on its cord, much good that had done, and the black scarf tied around his neck. A ribbon on her present, the bloody woman called it. He rolled over and snatched his silver-mounted pipe and tobacco pouch from the small table on the other side from her. Golden tongs and a hot coal in a golden bowl of sand provided the means for lighting. Folding his arms, he puffed away as fiercely as he frowned. "You should not flounce, duckling, and you shouldn't pout."
She yanked her dagger from where it was driven into a bedpost beside her marriage knife, examining the point before sheathing it.
"What is the matter?
You know you enjoyed yourself as much as I did, and I..." She laughed suddenly and oh so richly, resheathing the marriage knife as well.
"If that is part of what being Taviran means, you must be very popular."
Matt flushed like fire.
"It isn't natural," he burst out, yanking the pipe stem from between his teeth. "I'm the one who's supposed to do the chasing."
Her astonished eyes surely mirrored his own. Had Tylan been a tavern maid who smiled the right way, he might have tried his luck. Well, if the tavern maid lacked a son who liked poking holes in people. But he was the one who chased. He had just never thought of it that way before. He had never had the need to before. Tylan began laughing, shaking her head and wiping at her eyes with her fingers.
"Oh, Pigeon, I do keep forgetting. You are in Ebu Dar now. I left a little present for you in the sitting room."
She patted his foot through the sheet.
"Eat well today. You are going to need your strength."
Matt put a hand over his eyes and tried very hard not to weep. When he uncovered them, she was gone. Climbing out of the bed, he tucked the sheet around him. For some reason, the notion of walking around bare felt uncomfortable. The bloody woman might leap out of the wardrobe. The garments he had been wearing lay on the floor. Why bother with laces, he thought sourly, when you can just cut somebody's clothes off? She had no call to slice up his red coat that way, though. She had just enjoyed peeling him with her knife. Not quite holding his breath, he pulled open the tall red and gilt wardrobe. She was not hiding inside. His choices were limited. Nerim had most of his coats for cleaning or mending. Dressing quickly, he chose a plain coat of dark bronze silk, then stuffed the sliced rags as far under the bed as he could reach until he could dispose of them without Nerim seeing. Or anyone else, for that matter. Too many people already knew entirely too much of what was going on between him and Tylan. There was no way he could face anybody knowing this. In the sitting room, he lifted the lid of the lacquerware box by the door, then let it fall with a sigh. He had not really expected Tylan to replace the key. He leaned against the door. The unlocked door. Light, what was he going to do? Move back to the inn? Burn why the dice had stopped before. Only he would not put it past Tylan to bribe Mistress Anan and Enid, or the innkeeper wherever he went. He would not put it past Nynaeve and Elaine to claim he had broken some agreement and put an end to their promises.
Burn all women.
A large parcel, elaborately wrapped in green paper, sat on one of the tables. It contained an eagle mask in black and gold, and a coat covered with feathers to match. There was also a red silk purse holding 20 gold crowns, and a note that smelled of flowers.
I would have bought you an earring, Piglet, but I noticed your ear is not pierced. Have it done, and buy yourself something nice.
He nearly wept again. He gave women presents. The world was standing on its head.
Piglet?
Oh, light! After a minute, he did take the mask. She owed him that much, for his coat alone. When he finally reached the small shaded courtyard, where they had been meeting each morning beside a tiny round pool of lily pads and brightly spotted white fish, he found Elysian and Brigitte ready for the festival of birds, too. The Tyran had contented himself with a plain green mask, but Brigitte's was a spray of yellow and red with a crest of plumes. Her golden hair hung loose, with feathers tied all down its length, and she wore a dress with a wide yellow belt, diaphanous, beneath more red and yellow feathers. It did not reveal nearly as much as Rosella's, yet it seemed about to every time she moved. He had never thought of her wearing a dress like other women. "Sometimes it's fun to be looked at," she said, poking him in the ribs when he commented. Her grin would have done for Nalesian, saying how much fun it was to pinch serving girls. "There's a lot more to it than feather dancers wore, but not enough to slow me down. And anyway, I cannot see we'll have to move quickly on this side of the river." The dice rattled in his head. "What kept you?" she went on. "You didn't make us wait so you could tickle a pretty girl, I hope." He hoped he was not blushing. He was not certain what excuse he would have made, but just then half a dozen men wearing feathered coats strolled into the courtyard, all with those narrow swords on their hips, all but one wearing an elaborate mask with colorful crest and beak that represented no bird ever seen by human eyes. The exception was Beslin, twirling his mask by its ribbon. "Oh, blood and bloody ashes, what's he doing here?" "Beslin?" Nalesian folded his hands in the pommel of his sword and shook his head in disbelief. "Why, burn my soul, he says he intends to spend the festival in your company. Some promise you two made, he says. I told him it would be deadly boring, but he wouldn't believe me." "I cannot think it is ever boring around Matt," Tylan's son said. His bow took them all in, but his dark eyes especially lingered on Brigitte. "I've never had so much fun as I did drinking with him and Lady Elaine's water on Swovan night. The truth, I remember little." He did not seem to recognize that water. Strangely, considering the taste she had shown in men, Beslin was fine-looking, maybe a little too fine, not at all her sort. Strangely, she smiled slightly and preened under his scrutiny. Right then, Matt did not care how out of character she behaved. Obviously, Beslin suspected nothing, or that sort of his likely would already be out, but the last thing under the light Matt wanted was a day in company with the man. It would be excruciating. He had some sense of decency, even if Beslin's mother did not. The only problem was Beslin, who took that bloody promise to attend all the festivals and feast days together very seriously. The more Matt agreed with Nalesian that the day they had planned would be dull beyond belief, the more determined Beslin grew. After a bit, his face began to darken, and Matt began to think that sword might be unsheathed yet. Well, a promise was a promise. When he and Nalesian and Brigitte left the palace, half a dozen feathered fools strutted along. Matt was sure it would not have happened had Brigitte been wearing her proper clothes. The whole lot of them kept eyeing her and smiling. "What was all that twisting around while he was spilling his eyes all over you?" he muttered as they crossed the Mulhara. He tugged the ribbon holding the eagle mask tighter.
"I did not twist, I moved."
Her primness was so blatantly false, he would have laughed some other time.
"Slightly."
Abruptly her grin was back, and she lowered her voice for his ear alone. "I told you, sometimes it's fun to be looked at. Just because they're all too pretty doesn't mean I cannot enjoy them looking." "Oh, you'll want to look at her," she added,
pointing to a slender woman who went running by in a blue owl mask and rather fewer feathers than Rosella had worn. That was one of the things about Brigida. She would nudge him in the ribs and point out a pretty girl for his eye as readily as any man he had ever known, and expect him to point out in turn what she liked to see, which was generally the ugliest man in sight. Whether or not she chose to go half-naked today, a quarter anyway, she was, well, a friend. A strange world it was turning out to be. One woman he was beginning to think of as a drinking companion, and another after him as intently as he had ever pursued any pretty woman. In those old memories or his own. More intently, he had never chased any woman who let him know she did not want to be chased. A very strange world. The sun stood little more than halfway to its peak, but already celebrants filled the streets and squares and bridges. Tumblers and jugglers and musicians, with feathers sewn about their clothes, performed at every street corner, the music often drowned in laughter and shouting. For the poorer folk, a few feathers laced into their hair sufficed, pigeon feathers gathered from the pavement for the street children dodging about and the beggars. But masks and costumes grew more elaborate as purses grew heavier. More elaborate, and frequently more scandalous. Men and women alike were often decked in feathers that revealed more skin than Rosella or that woman back in the Malhara. No commerce moved in the streets or canals today, though a number of shops seemed to be open, along with every tavern and inn, of course. But here and there a wagon made its way through the throng, or a barge was pulled along, supporting a platform where young women and men posed in bright bird masks that covered their entire heads, with spreading crests sometimes rising a full pace, moving long, colorful wings in such a way that the rest of their costumes were exposed only in flashes, which was just as well, considering. According to Beslan, these settings, as they were called, were usually presented in guild halls and private palaces and houses. The entire festival normally took place indoors for the most part. It did not snow properly in Ebudar, even when the weather was as it should be. Beslan said he would like to see this snow one day. But apparently ordinary winter was cold enough to keep people from running around outdoors all but unclothed. With the heat, everything was spilling into the streets. Wait until night fell, Beslan said. Then Matt would really see something. As sunlight faded, so did inhibitions. Staring at a tall, slender woman gliding along through the crowd in mask and feathered cloak, and beyond that, six or seven feathers, Matt wondered what inhibitions some of these folk had left to shed. He almost shouted at her to cover herself with that cloak. She was pretty, but out in the street? Before the light and everybody? Those wagons carrying the settings attracted followers, of course. Thick knots of men and women who shouted and laughed as they tossed coins, and sometimes folded notes onto the wagons, and squeezed everyone else in the street aside. He became used to fleeing ahead until they could duck down a crossing street, or waiting until the setting went by to cross an intersection or bridge. While waiting, Brigitte and Nalician tossed coins to filthy urchins and dirtier beggars. Well, Nalician tossed. Brigitte concentrated on the children, and pressed each coin into a grubby hand like a gift. In one of those waits, Beslan suddenly put a hand on Elysian's arm, raising his voice above the crowd and a cacophony of music coming from at least six different places. "Forgive me, Tyrin, but not him." A ragged man edged back into the throng, warily. Gaunt-cheeked and bony, he seemed to have lost whatever pitiful feathers he might have found for his hair. "Why not?" Elysian demanded. "No brass ring on his little finger," Beslan replied. "He's not in the guild." "Light," Matt said. "A man can't even beg in this city without belonging to a guild." Maybe it was his tone. The beggar leaped for his throat, a knife appearing in his grimy fist. Without thinking, Matt grabbed the man's arm and spun, slinging him away into the crowd. Some people cursed at Matt, some at the sprawling beggar. Some tossed the fellow a coin. From the corner of his eye, Matt saw a second skinny man in rags try to push Brigitte out of the way to reach him with a long knife. It was a foolish mistake to underestimate the woman because of her costume. From somewhere among those feathers, she produced a knife and stabbed him beneath the arm. "Look out!" Matt shouted at her,
but there was no time for warnings. Even as he shouted, he drew from his coat sleeve and threw side-armed. The blade streaked past her face to sink into the throat of yet another beggar flaunting steel before he could plant it in her ribs. Suddenly there were beggars everywhere with knives and clubs studded with spikes. Screams and shouts rose as people in masks and costumes scrambled to get out of the way. Nalesian slashed a man in rags across the face, sending him reeling. Veslin ran another through the middle, while his costumed cronies fought still others. Matt had no time to see more. He found himself back-to-back with Brigida and facing his own adversaries. He could feel her shifting against him, hear her mutter curses, but he was barely conscious of it. Brigida could take care of herself, and watching the two men in front of him, he was not sure he could do the same. The hulking fellow with the toothless sneer had only one arm and a puckered socket where his left eye had been, but his fist held a club 2 feet long, encircled by iron bands that sprouted spikes like steel thorns. His rat-faced little companion still had both eyes and several teeth, and despite sunken cheeks and arms that seemed all bone and sinew, he moved like a snake, licking his lips and flicking a rusty dagger from hand to hand. Matt aimed the shorter knife in his own hand, first at one, then the other. It was still long enough to reach a man's vitals, and they danced and shuffled, each waiting for the other to leap at him first.
"Old Cully won't like this spar," the bigger man growled, and Ratface darted forward, rusty blade flashing from hand to hand.
He did not count on the knife that suddenly appeared in Matt's left hand, and sliced across his wrist. The dagger clattered to the paving stones, but the fellow flung himself at Matt anyway. As Matt's other blade stabbed into his chest, he squealed, eyes going wide, arms wrapping around Matt convulsively. The bald fellow's sneer widened, his club rising as he stepped in. The grin vanished as two beggars swarmed over him, snarling and stabbing. Staring incredulously, Matt shoved Ratface's corpse away. The street was clear for 50 paces except for combatants, and everywhere beggars rolled on the pavement, two or three or sometimes four stabbing at one, beating him with clubs or rocks. Beslin caught Matt's arm. There was blood on his face, but he was grinning.
"Let's get out of here, and let the Fellowship of Alms finish its business. There's no honor in fighting beggars, and besides, the guild won't leave any of these interlopers alive. Follow me."
Nalesian was scowling. Doubtless he saw no honor in fighting beggars either, and Beslin's friends, several with their costumes awry, and one with his mask off so another could dab at a cut across his forehead. The man with the cut was grinning too. Brigida bore not a scratch that Matt could see, and her costume looked as neat as it had back in the palace. She made her knife disappear. There was no way she could hide a blade under those feathers, but she did. Matt made no protest at being drawn away, but he did growl,
"Do beggars always go around attacking people in this city?"
Beslin might not appreciate hearing it called a bloody city. The man laughed.
"You are Tavirin, Matt. There's always excitement around Tavirin."
Matt smiled back with gritted teeth.
"Bloody fool, bloody city, and bloody Tavirin.
Well, if a beggar slit his throat, he would not have to go back to the palace and let Tylin peel him like a ripe pear." Come to think of it, she had called him her little pear.
"Bloody everything!"
The street between the dyer's shop and the Rose of the Elbar had its share of revelers, though not many scantily clad. Apparently you had to have coin to go near naked. Though the acrobats in front of the merchant's house on the corner came close, the men barefoot and bare-chested in tight, brightly colored breeches, the women in even tighter breeches and thin blouses. They all had a few feathers in their hair, as did the capering musicians playing in front of the small palace at the far corner. A woman with a flute, another blowing on a tall, twisted black tube covered with levers, and a fellow beating a tambour for all he was worth. The house they had come to watch looked shut up tight. The tea at the Rose was as bad as ever, which meant it was much better than the wine. Elysian stuck to the sour local ale. Brigida said thanks without saying for what, and Matt shrugged it off silently. They grinned at each other and tapped cups. The sun rose, and Beslin sat balancing first one boot on the toe of the other, then the other way around, but his companions began growing restive, no matter how often he pointed out that Matt was Tavirin. A scuffle with beggars was hardly proper excitement. The street was too narrow for any settings to pass. The women were not as pretty as elsewhere,
and even looking at Brigida seemed to pall once they realized that she did not intend to kiss even one of them. With protestations of regret that Beslan would not come, they hurried off to find somewhere more exhilarating. Nalesian took a stroll down the alley beside the Dyers, and Brigida vanished into the rose's murky interior to find, she said, whether there was anything at all fit to drink hidden in some forgotten corner. "I never expected to see a warder garbed like that," Beslan said, changing his boots around. Matt blinked. The fellow had sharp eyes. She had not removed her mask once. Well, as long as he did not know about. "I think you will be good for my mother, Matt." Choking, Matt sprayed tea into the passers-by. Several glared at him angrily, and one slender woman with a nice little bosom gave him a coy smile from beneath the blue mask he thought was meant to be a wren. She stamped a foot and stalked off when he did not smile back. Luckily, no one was angry enough to take it beyond glares before they too went on their way. Or maybe unluckily. He would not have minded if 6 or 8 piled on him right then. "What do you mean?" he said hoarsely. Beslan's head whipped around in wide-eyed surprise. "Why, her choosing you for her pretty, of course. Why is your face so red? Are you angry? Why?" Suddenly he slapped his forehead and laughed.
"You think I will be angry? Forgive me. I forget you're an outlander. Matt, she's my mother, not my wife. Father died 10 years ago, and she has always claimed to be too busy. I'm just glad she chose someone I like. Where are you going?"
He did not realize he was on his feet until Beslan spoke. "I just need to clear my head."
"But you're drinking tea, Matt."
Dodging around a green sedan chair, he half saw the door of the house open, and a woman with a blue feathered cloak over her dress slip out. Unthinkingly, his head was spinning too much to think clearly, he fell in behind her.
Beslan knew. He approved. His own mother, and he...
"Matt!" Nalesian shouted behind him. "Where are you going?"
"If I'm not back by tomorrow," Matt shouted back absently over his shoulder, "tell them they'll have to find it for themselves."
He walked on after the woman in a daze, not hearing if Nalesian or Beslan shouted again.
The man knew.
He remembered once thinking that Beslan and his mother were both mad.
They were worse. All of Ebu Dar was mad.
He was hardly aware of the dice still spinning inside his skull.
From a window of the meeting room, Rihanna watched Solane disappear down the street toward the river. Some fellow in a bronze coat followed in her wake, but if he tried to impede her, he would find out soon enough that Solane had no time for men, and no patience with them. Rihanna was not sure why the urge had grown so strong today. For days it had come on almost with the morning and faded with the sun, and for days she had fought. By the strict rules they did not quite dare call laws, that order was given at the half moon, still 6 nights off. But today... she had spoken the order before she thought, and been unable to make herself retract until the proper time. It would be well. No one had seen any sign of those two young fools calling themselves Elaine and Nynaeve anywhere in the city. Thank the light, there had been no need to take dangerous chances. Sighing, she turned to the others, who waited until she took her chair before seating themselves. It would be well, as it always had been. Secrets would be kept, as they always had been. But still... she had no touch of foretelling or anything of that sort, yet perhaps that overwhelming urge had been telling her something. 12 women watched her expectantly. "I think we should consider moving everyone who does not wear the belt to the farm for a little while." There was little discussion. They were the elders, but she was the eldest. In that, at least, there was no harm in behaving as Aes Sedai did. Chapter 30. The First Cup. "I do not understand this," Elaine protested. She had not been offered a chair. In fact, when she started to sit, she'd been told curtly to remain standing. 5 sets of eyes were focused on her, 5 women with set, grim faces. You are behaving as if we've done something terrible, when what we have done is find the bowl of the winds. At least they were on the brink of it, she hoped. The message Nalisian had come running back with was none too clear. Matt had gone off shouting that he had found it, or something very like, Nalisian allowed. The longer he talked, the more he bounced between absolute certainty and doubt. Birgitta had remained watching Rihanna's house. She seemed to be sweaty and bored. In any case, matters were in motion. Elaine wondered how Nynaeve was getting on. Better than herself, she hoped. She had certainly never expected this when she revealed their success. "You have endangered a secret kept close by every woman to wear the shawl for over 2,000 years. Marilla sat stiff-backed, serenity almost abandoned, on the tight-lipped brink of apoplexy. "You must have been insane. Only madness could excuse this." "What secret?" Elaine demanded. Van Deen, flanking Marilla with her sister, adjusted pale green silk skirts irritably and said, "Time enough for that when you've been properly raised, child. I thought you had some sense." Adelius, in a dark gray wool with deep brown trim, nodded, mirroring Van Deen's disapproval. "The child cannot be faulted for revealing a secret she did not know," Kariana Francie said from Elaine's left, shifting her bulk in her green and gilt armchair. She was not stout, but almost, with shoulders as wide and arms as thick as most men. "Tower law does not allow for excuses," Saritha put in quickly, in somewhat self-important tones, her normally inquisitive brown eyes stern. "Once mere excuses are allowed, inevitably lesser and lesser excuses will become acceptable, until law itself is gone." Her high-backed chair stood to the right. Only she wore her shawl, but Marilla's sitting room had been arranged as a court, though no one called it that. So far, no one had. Marilla, Adelius, and Van Deen confronted Elaine like judges. Saritha's chair was placed where the seat of rebuke would be, and Kariana's the seat of pardon. But the Damani Green, who would have been her defender, nodded thoughtfully, as the Tyron Brown, who would have been her prosecutor, continued. "She has admitted guilt from her own mouth. I recommend that the child be confined to the palace until we leave, with some good hard work to occupy her mind and her hands. I also recommend a firm dose of the slipper at regular intervals, to remind her not to go behind sisters' backs. And the same for Nynaeve, as soon as she can be found." Elaine swallowed. Confined? Perhaps they did not need to name this a trial for it to be one. Saritha might not yet have achieved the ageless face, but the weight of the other women's years pressed at Elaine. Adelius and Van Deen, with their hair nearly all white, even their ageless faces echoing years. Marilla's hair was glossy black, yet Elaine would not have been surprised to learn she had worn the shawl as long or longer than most women not Aes Sedai lived. For that matter, Kariana might have as well. Not one of them approached her own strength and the power, but all that experience as Aes Sedai, all that knowledge, all that authority. A heavy reminder that she was only 18 and had been in novice white a year ago. Kariana made no move to rebut Saritha's suggestions. Perhaps she best go on defending herself. "Plainly this secret you speak of has something to do with the circle, but the kin are no concern of yours, child," Marilla broke in sharply. Drawing a deep breath, she smoothed gold-slashed skirts of silvery gray. "I propose to pass sentence," she said in a cold voice. "I concur and defer to your decision," Adelius said. She gave Elaine a disappointed frown and shook her head. Van Deen waved her hand dismissively. "I concur and defer, but I agree with the seat of rebuke." Kariana's look might have contained a sliver of sympathy. Maybe a sliver. Marilla opened her mouth. The timid knock at the door sounded quite loud in the momentary thunderous silence. "What under the light?" Marilla muttered angrily. "I told Paul not to let anyone disturb us. Kariana?" Not the youngest, but the lowest in strength, Kariana stood and glided to the door. Despite her heft, she always moved like a swan. It was Paul herself, Marilla's maid, who popped in curtsying left and right. A slender, gray-haired woman, usually possessed of a dignity to rival that of her mistress, she wore an anxious frown now, as well she might, barging in after Marilla's instructions. Elaine had not been so glad to see anyone since Matt Cawthon appeared in the Stone of Tyr. A horrendous thought. If Avienda did not say she had met Toe sufficiently soon, she might just see if asking the man to beat her after all could end the agony. "The Queen brought this herself," Paul announced breathily, proffering a letter sealed with a large red lump of wax. "She said if I didn't give it to Elaine right away, she'd bring it in herself. She said it's about the child's mother." Elaine almost ground her teeth. The sisters' serving women had all picked up their mistress's way of talking about Nynaeve and her, if seldom where they could hear. Furious, she snatched the letter without waiting for Marilla to say she could, if that was what she would have said, and broke the seal with her thumb. "My Lady Elaine, I greet the daughter heir of Andor with joyous news. I have but just learned that your mother, Queen Morghese, lives, and is at present the guest of Pedro Nile in Amador, and wishes above all to be reunited with you, so that you may return to Andor together in triumph. I offer escort through the bandits now infesting Altara, so that you may reach your mother's side in safety and all speed. Forgive these few poor words, scribbled in haste, but I know you would wish to learn the wondrous news as soon as possible. Until I can leave you at your mother's side. Sealed in the light. Jaqim Carradine." The paper crumpled in her fist. How dare he! The pain of her mother's death, without even a body to be buried, was only beginning to fade, and Carradine dared mock her this way? Embracing the true source, she hurled the foul lies away from her and channeled. Fire flared in mid-air, so hot that only a dust of ash fell to the blue and gold floor tiles. That for Jaqim Carradine! And as for these women! The pride of 1,000 years of Andoran queens put steel into her backbone. Marilla surged to her feet. You were not given permission to channel. You will release the... Leave us, Paul, Elaine said. Now! The serving woman stared, but Elaine's mother had taught her well the voice of command, the voice of a queen from her throne. Paul bobbed a curtsy and was moving before she realized. Once underway, she hesitated only an instant before hurrying out and closing the door behind her. Whatever was about to happen, plainly, was for Aes Sedai alone. "What has gotten into you, child?" Pure fury submerged the remnants of Marilla's regathered calm. "Release the source immediately, or I vow I'll fetch a slipper myself this minute." "I am Aes Sedai." The words came out like winter stone, and Elaine meant them to. Carradine's lies, and these women. Marilla threatened to slipper her? They would acknowledge her rightful place as a sister. She and Nynaeve had found the bowl, as good as anyway, and the arrangements for its use were underway. "You propose to punish me for endangering a secret apparently known only to sisters, but no one bothered to tell me this secret when I attained the shawl. You suggest punishing me like a novice or accepted, but I am Aes Sedai. I was raised to the shawl by Egwene Alvear, the Armorlin you claim to serve. If you deny that Nynaeve and I are Aes Sedai, then you deny the Armorlin seat who sent me to find the Bowl of the Winds, which we have done. I will not have it. I call you to account, Marilla Sion Devon. Submit to the will of the Armorlin seat, or I will call judgment on you as a rebellious traitor." Marilla's eyes bulged, and her mouth hung open, but she appeared composed beside Kariana or Saritha, who looked about to choke to death on incredulity. Vandine seemed mildly taken aback, a thoughtful finger pressed to her lips beneath slightly widened eyes, while Adelia sat forward, studying Elaine as if seeing her for the first time. Channeling, Elaine floated one of the tall armchairs to her and sat, composing her skirts. "You may as well sit, too, Marilla." She still used the voice of command. Apparently it was the only way to make them listen, but she was startled when Marilla actually sank back down slowly, staring at her pop-eyed. Outside, she maintained a calm, cool facade, but inside anger bubbled. No, it boiled. Secrets. She'd always thought Aes Sedai kept too many secrets, even from each other. Especially from each other. True, she kept some herself, but only at necessity, and not from anyone who needed to know. And these women had thought to punish her. "Your authority comes from the hall of the tower, Marilla. Nynaeve's and mine from the Ammerlin seat. Ours supersedes yours. From now on, you will take your instructions from Nynaeve or me. We will, of course, listen carefully to any advice you might offer." She had thought Marilla's eyes bulged before, but now... "Impossible!" the Grey spluttered. "You are Marilla," Elaine said sharply, leaning forward. "Do you still deny the authority of your Ammerlin? Do you still dare?" Marilla's mouth worked soundlessly. She wet her lips. She shook her head jerkily. Elaine felt a thrill of exultation. All that about Marilla taking direction was stuff and nonsense, of course, but she would be acknowledged. Tom and her mother both said you must begin by asking for 10 to get 1. Still, that was not enough to damp her anger. She had half a mind to fetch a slipper herself and see how far she could push this. Except, that would shatter everything. They would remember her age fast enough then, and how short a time ago she had put off a novice dress. They might even begin thinking of her as a foolish child again, which thought stoked her fury anew. But she contented herself with, "While you think quietly on what else I should be told as Aes Sedai, Marilla, Adelius and Van Deen will instruct me in this secret I endangered. Do you mean to tell me the tower has known of the circle, these kin, as you call them, all along?" Poor Rihanna, and her hopes to avoid Aes Sedai notice. "As near as they could make themselves come to sisters, I suppose," Van Deen replied, carefully. She studied Elaine as intently as her sister did now. Though a Green, she had many of the same mannerisms as Adelius. Carianna and Saritha looked stunned, disbelieving eyes swinging from a silent, red-cheeked Marilla to Elaine and back. Even during the Trolloc Wars, women failed their tests, or lacked the strength, or were sent away from the tower for any of the usual reasons. Adelius had adopted a lecturing tone, but not offensively. Browns often did when expounding. Under the circumstances, it is hardly surprising that a number feared to go off into the world alone, nor that they might flee to Barashta, as the city that existed here then was called. Though the main part of Barashta was, of course, where the Rahad now stands. Not that a stone of Barashta remains. The Trolloc Wars did not truly envelop Iharon until late, but in the end Barashta fell as completely as Barsine, or Shemal, or... "The kin," Van Deen broke in gently. Adelius blinked at her, then nodded. "The kin persisted even after Barashta fell, in the same way they had before, taking in wilders and women put out of the tower." Elaine frowned. Mistress Anan had said the kin took in wilders, too, but Rihanna's biggest anxiety had seemed to be making her and Nynaeve prove they were not. "None ever remained long," Adelius added. "5 years, perhaps 10, then, I suppose, as now. Once they realize that their little group is no replacement for the White Tower, they go off and become village healers or wisdoms or the like, or sometimes simply forget the power, stop channeling and take up a craft or trade. In any case, they vanish, so to speak." Elaine wondered how anyone could forget the One Power that way. The urge to channel, the temptation of the source, was always there, once you learned how. Aes Sedai did seem to believe some women could just put it behind them, though, once they found out they would not be Aes Sedai. Van Deen took up the explanation again. The sisters frequently spoke almost in alternating sentences, each carrying on smoothly where the other left off. The tower has known of the kin from nearly the beginning, perhaps from the very beginning. At first, no doubt, the wars took precedence, and despite calling themselves the kin, they have done just what we want such women to do. They remain hidden. Even the fact that they can channel draw no attention whatsoever to themselves. Over the years, they've even passed along word, secretly, of course, carefully, when one of them found a woman falsely claiming the shawl. You said something? Elaine shook her head. Kariana, is there any tea in that pot? Kariana gave a small start. I think Adelius and Van Deen might like to wet their throats. The Damani woman did not quite look at a still-staring Marilella before going to the table where the silver teapot and cups were. That doesn't explain why, Elaine went on. Why is knowledge of them such a deep secret? Why haven't they been scattered long ago? Why, the runaways, of course. Adelius made it sound the most obvious thing in the world. It is a fact that other gatherings have been broken up as soon as found, the last about 200 years ago, but the kin do keep themselves small and quiet. That last group called themselves the Daughters of Silence, yet they were hardly silent. Only 23 of them altogether, wilders gathered and trained after a fashion by a pair of former accepted, but they... Runaways, Elaine prompted, taking a cup from Kariana with a smile of thanks. She had not asked one for herself, but she realized absently that the woman had offered her the first. Van Deen and her sister had talked quite a bit about runaways on the way to Ebudar. Adelius blinked and pulled herself back to the topic. The kin help runaways. They always have 2 or 3 women in Tarvalen keeping watch. For one thing, they approach almost every woman put out in a very circumspect way, and for another, they manage to find every runaway, whether novice or accepted. At least none has made it off the island without their help since the Trolloc Wars. Oh, yes, Van Deen said as Adelius paused to take a cup from Kariana. It had been offered to Marilella first, but Marilella sat slumped and staring bleakly at nothing. If anyone does manage to escape, why, we know right where to look, and she nearly always ends up back in the tower wishing her feet had never itched. As long as the kin don't know we know, anyway. Once that happens, it will be back to the days before the kin, when a woman running from the tower might go in any direction. The numbers were larger then. Aes Sedai, accepted, novices and runaways. And some years, 2 out of 3 escaped clean. Others, 3 out of 4. Using the kin, we retake at least 9 of 10. You can see why the tower has preserved the kin and their secret like precious jewels. Elaine could. A woman was not done with the White Tower until it was done with her. Besides, it could not hurt the tower's reputation for infallibility that it always caught runaways. Almost always. Well, now she knew. She stood, and to her astonishment, Adelius did also, and Van Deen, waving away Kariana's offered tea, and Saritha. Even Marilella, after a moment. They all looked at her expectantly. Even Marilella. Van Deen noticed her surprise and smiled. Another thing you might not know. We are a contentious lot in many ways, we Aes Sedai, each jealous of her place and prerogatives. But when someone is placed above us or stands above us, we tend to follow her fairly meekly for the most part, however we might grumble about her decisions in private. Why, so we do, Adelius murmured happily, as if she had just discovered something. Marilella took a deep breath, absorbing herself for a moment in straightening her skirts. Van Deen is right, she said. You stand above us in yourself, and I must admit you apparently have been placed above us. If our behavior calls for penance, well, you will tell us if it does. Where are we to follow you, if I may ask? There was no sarcasm in any of that. If anything, her tone was more polite than Elaine had heard out of her before. She thought any Aes Sedai who ever lived would have been proud to control her features as well as she did right then. All she had wanted was for them to admit she really was Aes Sedai. She fought a momentary urge to protest that she was too young, too inexperienced. "You can never put honey back in the comb," so Lini used to say when she was a girl. Egwene was no older. Drawing breath, she smiled warmly. "The first thing to recall is that we are all sisters, in every meaning of the word. We must work together. The Bowl of the Winds is too important for anything less." She hoped they would all nod so enthusiastically when she told them what Egwene intended. "Perhaps we should sit again." They waited for her before folding themselves back into their seats. She hoped Nynaeve was getting on a tenth so well. When she found out about this, Nynaeve was going to faint from shock. "I have something of my own to tell you about the kin." Fairly soon it was Marilla who looked ready to faint from shock, and even Adelius and Van Deen were not far from it. But they went right on saying, "Yes, Elaine, and if you say so, Elaine." Perhaps it would all go smoothly from now on. The sedan chair was rocking through the crowds of revelers along the quay when Mogedion spotted the woman. She was being handed down from a coach at one of the boat landings by a footman in green and white. A wide, feathered mask covered her face more completely than Mogedion's did, but she would have known that determined stride, known that woman, from any angle in any light. The carved screens that served as windows in the closed chair were certainly no hindrance. Two fellows with swords on their hips scrambled from the coach roof to follow the masked woman. Mogedion thumped a fist against the side of the chair, shouting, "Stop!" The bearers halted so quickly she was almost flung forward. The crowd jostled past, some shouting curses at her bearers for blocking the way, some shouting more good-naturedly. Down here by the river, the throng ran thin enough for her to watch through the gaps. The boat that pulled away from the landing seemed quite distinctive. The roof of the low cabin in the rear was painted red. She did not see that affectation on any of the others waiting at the long stone dock. She wet her lips, shivering. Moradin's instructions had been explicit, the price of disobedience made excruciatingly clear. But a slight delay would not hurt. Not if he never learned of it, anyway. Flinging open the door, she climbed out into the street and looked about hastily. There, that inn, right overlooking the docks, and the river. Lifting her skirts, she hurried away without the slightest fear anyone might hire her chair. Until she untied the webs of compulsion on them, the bearers would tell anyone who asked that they were engaged, and stand there until they died of hunger. A path opened ahead of her, men and women in feathered masks leaping aside before she reached them, leaping with squeals and cries as they clutched where they thought they had been stabbed. As they had. There was no time to spin subtle webs on so many minds, but a flurry of needles woven of air did as well here. The stout innkeeper at the oarsman's pride nearly leaped, too, at the sight of Mogedion striding into her common room in gloriously scarlet silk, worked with thread of gold, and black silk that glistened as richly as the gold. Her mask was a great spray of pitch-black feathers with a sharp black beak, a raven. That was Moradin's joke, his command, as was the dress, in fact. His colors were black and red, he said, and she would wear them while she served him. She was in livery, however elegant, and she could have killed everyone who saw her. Instead, she spun a hasty web on the round-cheeked innkeeper that jerked her up straight and made her eyes pop. No time for subtlety. At Mogedion's command to show her the roof, the woman ran up the railless stairs at the side of the room. It was unlikely any of the feather-draped drinkers saw anything unusual in the innkeeper's behavior, Mogedion thought with a small laugh. The oarsman's pride probably had never seen a patron of her quality before. On the flat roof, she quickly weighed the dangers of letting the innkeeper live versus those of killing her. Corpses had a way of pointing a finger eventually. If you wished to remain quietly hidden in the shadows, you did not kill unless you absolutely had to. Hastily she adjusted the web of compulsion, told the woman to go down to her room to go to sleep, and forget ever having seen her. With the haste, it was possible the innkeeper might lose the whole day, or wake somewhat slower of wits than she had been. So much in Mogedion's life would have been so much easier had she possessed a better talent for compulsion. But in any case, the woman scurried away, eager to obey, and left her alone. As the door thumped down flat into the dirty white-tiled roof, Mogedion gasped at the sudden feel of fingers stroking her mind, palping her soul. Moradin did that sometimes. A reminder, he said, as if she needed any more. She almost looked around for him. Her skin pebbled as though at a sudden icy breeze. The touch vanished, and she shivered again. Coming or going, it did remind her. Moradin himself could appear anywhere at any time. Haste. Speeding to the low wall that surrounded the roof, she searched the river spread out below. Scores of boats of every size swept along on their oars between larger vessels, anchored or under sail. Most of the cabins of the sort she sought were plain wood, but there she saw a yellow roof, and there a blue, and there, in mid-river and heading southward fast, red. It had to be the right one. She could not take any more time here. She raised her hands, but as balefire launched itself, something flashed around her and she jerked. Moradin had come. He was here, and he would... She stared at the pigeons fluttering away. Pigeons. She nearly spewed the contents of her stomach across the roof. A glance at the river made her snarl. Because she had jerked, the balefire she meant to slice through cabin and passenger instead had sliced diagonally through the middle of the boat, about where the oarsmen had stood and the bodyguards. Because the rowers had been burned out of the pattern before the balefire struck, the two halves of the craft were now a good 100 paces back up the river. Then again, perhaps it was not a complete disaster, because that slice from the boat's center had gone at the same time the boatmen really died. The river had had minutes to rush in. The two parts of the boat sank out of sight in a great froth of bubbles, even as her eyes shifted to them, carrying their passenger to the depths. Suddenly what she had done struck her. She had always moved in the dim places, always kept herself hidden, always... Any woman in the city who could channel would know someone had drawn a great deal of Sidar, if not for what, and any eye watching had seen that bar of liquid white fire sear across the afternoon. Fear gave her wings. Not fear. Terror. Gathering her skirts, she ran back down the stairs, ran through the common room, bumping into tables and careering off people trying to get out her way, ran into the street too frightened to think, battering a path through the crowd with her hands. "Run!" she shrieked, hurling herself into the sedan chair. Her skirts caught in the door, she ripped them free. "Run!" The bearers flung themselves into motion, tossing her about, but she did not care. She braced herself with fingers laced through the carved wooden screens and shook uncontrollably. He had not forbidden this. He might forgive or even ignore her independent action here, if she carried out his instructions swiftly, efficiently. That was her only hope. She was going to make Phelion and Ispan crawl. Chapter 31. Mashiara. As the boat swept away from the landing, Nynaeve tossed her mask down beside her on the cushioned bench and slumped back with arms folded and braid gripped firmly, scowling at nothing, scowling at everything. Listening to the wind still told her a fierce storm was on the way, the kind that tore off roofs and flattened barns, and she almost wished the river would begin to kick up in waves right that minute.
"If it isn't the weather, Nynaeve," she mimicked, "then you should be the one to go. The mistress of the ships might be insulted if we didn't send the strongest of us. They know Aes Sedai put great store in that." "Bah!"
That had been Elaine. Except for the bah! Elaine just thought putting up with any amount of nonsense from Merylilla would be preferable to facing Nesta again. Once you began badly with someone, it was hard to recover. Matt Coffin was proof enough of that. And if they had gotten off any worse with Nesta Dinrea's two moons, she would be sending the lot of them to fetch and carry. "Horrible woman," she grumbled, shifting around on the seat cushions. Avienda had been no better when Nynaeve suggested she go to the sea folk. Those people had been fascinated by her. She pitched her voice high and finicky. Not at all like Avienda's, but the mood fit.
"We will learn of this trouble when we learn, Nynaeve Almira. Perhaps I will learn something watching Jakim Cardine today."
If not for the fact that nothing whatsoever frightened the Aiel woman, she would have thought Avienda fearful from her eagerness to spy on Cardine. A day standing in a hot street jostled by crowds was not amusing, and today would be worse with the festival. Nynaeve would have thought the woman would enjoy a nice, refreshing boat ride. The boat lurched. "A nice, refreshing boat ride," she told herself. "Nice, cool breezes on the bay. Moist breezes, not dry." The boat rolled. "Oh, blood and ashes," she moaned. Appalled, she clapped a hand over her mouth and drummed her heels against the front of the bench in righteous outrage. If she had to endure those sea folk for long, she would have as much filth coming off of her tongue as Matt did. She did not want to think about him. One more day folding her hands for that man, and she would yank every hair out of her head. Not that he had demanded anything unreasonable so far, but she kept waiting for him to, and his manner. "No," she said firmly. "I want to settle my stomach, not rile it." The boat had begun a slow rocking. She tried to concentrate on her clothes. She was not fixated on clothes, the way Elaine sometimes seemed to be, but thinking about silks and laces was soothing. Everything had been chosen to impress the mistress of the ships, to try regaining a little lost ground, for all the good it might do. Green silk slashed with yellow in the skirts, embroidered in gold down the sleeves and across the bodice, with golden lace along the hem and at her wrists, and just bordering the neckline. Perhaps that should have been higher, to be taken seriously, but she did not own anything higher. Considering sea folk customs, it was more than modest. Nesta would have to take her as she was. Nynaeve Almira did not go changing herself for anyone. The yellow opal pins stuck in her braid were her own, a present from the Panarch of Tarabon, no less. But Tylin had provided the gold necklace that fanned emeralds and pearls down to her bosom. A richer piece than she had ever dreamed of owning. A gift for bringing Matt, Tylin had called it, which made no sense at all, but maybe the queen thought she needed some excuse for such a valuable present. Both gold and ivory bracelets came from Avienda, who had a surprising little stock of jewelry for a woman who so seldom wore more than that one silver necklace. Nynaeve had asked to borrow that pretty roses and thorns ivory bracelet that the Aiel woman never wore. Surprisingly, Avienda had snatched it to her bosom as if it was her most precious possession, and of all things, Elaine began comforting her. Nynaeve would not have been surprised to see the pair fall weeping on one another's shoulder. There was something odd going on there, and if she had not known those two were too sensible for such nonsense, she would have suspected a man at the root of it. Well, Avienda was too sensible. Elaine did still yearn for Rand, though Nynaeve could hardly fault her for... Suddenly she felt waves of Sidar almost atop her in huge amounts, and... She floundered in salty water over her head, flailing upward to find air, tangled in her skirts, flailing. Her head broke surface, and she gasped for breath amid floating cushions, staring in astonishment. After a moment she recognized the slanting shape above her as one of the cabin seats and a bit of the cabin wall. She was inside a trapped pocket of air. Not large. She could have touched both sides without stretching her arms out fully. But how? An audible thud announced the bottom of the river. The upside-down cabin lurched, tilted. She thought the air pocket shrank a little. The first order of business before wondering about anything was getting out before she used up the air. She knew how to swim. She had splashed in the Waterwood ponds often enough back home. It was just when the water started rocking about her that she minded. Filling her lungs, she doubled over and swam down toward where the door must be, kicking awkwardly because of her skirts. It might help to shed the dress, but she was not about to bob to the surface of the river in nothing but shift and stockings and jewels. She was not about to leave those behind, either. Besides, she could not get out of the dress without losing her belt pouch, and she would drown before losing what was in there. The water was black, lightless. Her outstretched fingers struck wood, and she felt across the piercework carving until she found the door, scrabbled down the edge of that, and found a hinge. Muttering imprecations in her head, she cautiously felt her way to the other side. Yes! The latch handle! She lifted it, pushed outward. The door moved maybe 2 inches, and stopped. Lungs straining, she swam back up to the pocket, but only long enough to fill them again. This time, finding the door came faster. She stuck her fingers through the crack to find what held the door shut. They sank into mud. Maybe she could dig away a little hillock, or... She felt higher. More mud. Increasingly frantic, she worked her fingers from the bottom of the crack to the top, and then, refusing to believe, from the top to the bottom. Mud. Solid, gooey mud all the way. This time, when she swam back up to the pocket, she grabbed hold of the edge of the seat above her and hung from it, panting, heart beating wildly. The air felt thicker. "I will not die here," she muttered. "I will not die here." She hammered a fist against the seat until she felt it bruise, fighting for the anger that would allow her to channel. She would not die. Not here. Alone. No one would know where she had died. No grave. Just a corpse rotting at the bottom of the river. Her arm fell with a splash. She labored for breath. Flecks of black and silver danced in her eyes. She seemed to be looking down a tube. No anger, she realized dimly. She kept trying to reach for Sidar, but without any belief that she would touch it now. She was going to die here after all. No hope, no Lan. And with hope gone, flickering on the edge of consciousness like a guttering candle flame, she did something she had never done before in her life. She surrendered completely. Sidar flowed into her, filled her. She was only half aware of the wood above her suddenly bulging outward, bursting. In rushing bubbles of air, she drifted up, out through the hole in the hull into darkness. Vaguely, she knew she should do something. She could almost remember what. Yes. Her feet kicked weakly. She tried to move her arms to swim. They seemed to just float. Something seized her dress, and panic roused her in thoughts of sharks and lionfish, and the light alone knew what else that might inhabit these black depths. A spark of consciousness spoke of the power, but she flailed desperately with fists and feet, felt her knuckles land solidly. Unfortunately, she also screamed, or tried to. A great quantity of water rushing down her throat washed away scream, Sidar, and very nearly her final scraps of awareness. Something tugged on her braid, then again, and she was being towed somewhere. She was no longer conscious enough to struggle, or even to be very much afraid of being eaten. Abruptly her head broke surface. Hands encircled her from behind. Hands, not a shark after all, squeezed hard against her ribs in a most familiar way. She coughed, water spewed from her nose, coughed again, painfully, and drew a shuddering breath. She had never tasted anything so sweet in her life. A hand cupped her chin, and suddenly she was being towed again. Lassitude washed through her. All she could do was float on her back and breathe and stare up at the sky. So blue. So beautiful. The stinging in her eyes was not all from the salty river. And then she was being pushed upward against the side of a boat, a rude hand beneath her bottom shoving her higher, until two lanky fellows with brass rings in their ears could reach down and haul her aboard. They helped her walk a step or two, but as soon as they let go to help her rescuer, her legs collapsed like towers of soggy mush. On unsteady hands and knees, she stared blankly at a sword and boots and green coat someone had thrown down on the deck. She opened her mouth and emptied herself of the river Elbar. The entire river, it seemed, plus her midday meal and her breakfast. It would not have surprised her at all to see a few fish, or her slippers. She was wiping her lips with the back of her hand when she became aware of voices. "My lord is all right? My lord was down for a very long time. Forget me, man, said a deep voice. Get something to wrap around the lady. Lan's voice, that she dreamed every night of hearing. Wide-eyed, Nynaeve barely bit back a wail. The horror she had felt when she thought she was going to die was nothing alongside what flashed through her now. Nothing! This was a nightmare. Not now! Not like this! Not when she was a drowned rat, kneeling with the contents of her stomach spread out before her! Without thought, she embraced Sidar and channeled. Water fell away from her clothes, her hair, in a rush, and washed all evidence of her little mishap out through a scupper-hole. Scrambling to her feet, she hurriedly pulled her necklace aright and did her best to straighten her dress and hair, but the soaking in salt water and then the rapid drying had left several stains on the silk, and a number of creases that would require a knowledgeable hand with a hot iron to remove. Wisps of hair wanted to fly away from her scalp, and the opals in her braid seemed to dot the bristling tail of an angry cat. It did not matter. She was calmness itself, cool as an early spring breeze, self-possessed as... She spun around before he could come on her from behind and startle her into disgracing herself completely. She only realized how quickly she had moved when she saw that Lan was just then taking his second step from the railing. He was the most beautiful man she had ever seen. Soaking wet in shirt and breeches and stockings, he was gorgeous, with his dripping hair clinging to the angles of his face, and a split purple bruise was rising on his face as from a blow. She clapped a hand to her mouth, remembering her fist connecting. "Oh, no! Oh, Lan, I'm so sorry! I didn't mean to!" She was not really aware of crossing the space between them. She was just there, stretching up on tiptoes to lay fingers gently on his injury. A deft weave of all five powers, and his tanned cheek was unblemished. But he might have been hurt elsewhere. She spun the weaves to delve him. New scars made her wince inside, and there was something odd, but he seemed healthy as a prime bull. He was also very wet from saving her. She dried him as she had herself. Water splashed around his feet. She could not stop touching him. Both hands traced his hard cheeks, his wonderful blue eyes, his strong nose, his firm lips, his ears. She combed that silky black hair into place with her fingers, adjusted the braided leather band that held it. Her tongue seemed to have a life of its own, too. "Oh, Lan," she murmured, "you really are here." Somebody giggled. Not her. Nynaeve Almira did not giggle, but somebody did. "It isn't a dream. Oh, Light, you're here. How?" "A servant at the Tarasin Palace told me you'd gone to the river, and a fellow at the landing said what boat you had taken. If Mandarb hadn't lost a shoe, I would have been here yesterday."
"I don't care. You're here now. You're here."
She did not giggle. "Maybe she is Aes Sedai," one of the boatmen murmured, not quite low enough. "But I still say she's one duckling who means to stuff herself in that wolf's jaws." Nynaeve's face flashed pure scarlet, and she snatched her hands to her sides, her heels thumping to the deck. Another time she would have given the fellow what for, and no mistake. Another time, when she could think.
Lan crowded everything else out of her head. She seized his arm. "We can talk more privately in the cabin." And one of the oarsmen snickered.
"My sword, and
I'll bring it,"
she said, snatching up his things from the deck on flows of air. One of those louts had snickered. Another flow of air pulled open the cabin door, and she hustled Lan and his sword and the rest inside and slammed it behind them. Light! She doubted if even Callie Copland back home had ever been as bold as this, and as many merchants' guards knew Callie's birthmark as knew her face. But it was not the same at all. Not at all. Still, no harm in being just a tad less... eager. Her hands went back to his face, only to straighten his hair some more. Just that, and he caught her wrists gently in his big hands. "Mirella holds my bond now," he said quietly. "She is lending me to you until you find a warder of your own." Calmly pulling her right hand free, she slapped his face as hard as she could swing. His head hardly moved, so she freed the other hand and slapped him harder with that. "How could you?" For good measure, she punctuated the question with another slap. "You knew I was waiting." One more seemed called for, just to drive the point home. "How could you do such a thing? How could you let her?" Another slap. "Burn you, Landmandragoran! Burn you! Burn you! Burn you to the pit of doom! Burn you!" The man, the bloody man, did not say one word. Not that he could, of course. What defense could he offer? He just stood there while she rained blows at him, making no move, unblinking eyes looking peculiar, as well they might with the way she reddened his cheeks for him. If her slaps made little impression on him, though, the palms of her hands began to sting like fury. Grimly she clenched a fist and punched him in the belly with all her might. He grunted, slightly. "We will talk this over calmly and rationally," she said, stepping back from him, "as adults." Lan just nodded and sat down and pulled his boots over to him. Pushing bits of hair out of her face with her left hand, she stuck the right behind her so she could flex her sore fingers without him seeing. He had no right being that hard, not when she wanted to hit him. Too much to hope she had cracked a rib in him.
"You should thank her, Nynaeve."
How could the man sound so calm? Stamping his foot firmly into one boot, he bent to pick up the other, not looking at her.
"You wouldn't want me bonded to you."
The flow of air seized a handful of his hair and bent his head up painfully. "If you dare, if you even dare, to spout that drivel about not wanting to give me a widow's weeds, Landmandragoran, I'll... She could not think of anything strong enough. Kicking him was not near enough. Mirella. Mirella and her warders. Burn him. Removing his hide in strips would not be enough. He might as well not have been bent over with his neck craned. He just rested his forearms across his knees and watched her with that odd look in his eyes and said,
"I thought about not telling you, but you have a right to know."
Even so, his tone became hesitant. Lan was never hesitant.
"When Moiraine died, when a warder's bond to his Aes Sedai is snapped, there are changes."
As he continued, her arms snaked around herself, hugging tightly to keep her from shivering. Her jaw ached, for she kept it clamped shut. She released the flow holding him as if a hand springing away released Sidar, but he only straightened and went on relating this horror without so much as a flinch, went on watching her. Suddenly she understood his eyes, colder than winter's heart. The eyes of a man who knew he was dead and could not make himself care. A man waiting, almost eager, for that long sleep. Her own eyes stung with not weeping.
"So you see,"
he concluded with a smile that touched only his mouth, an accepting smile.
"When it's done, she will have a year or more of pain, and I will still be dead. You are spared that. My last gift to you, Mashiara."
Mashiara, his lost love.
"You are to be my warder until I find one?"
Her voice startled her with its levelness.
"You are to be my warder until I find one?"
Her voice startled her with its levelness. She could not break down in tears now. She would not. Now, more than ever before, she had to gather all her strength.
"Yes," he said cautiously, tugging on his other boot. He'd always seemed something of a half-tame wolf, and his eyes made him seem much less than half-tame now.
"Good." Adjusting her skirts, she resisted the urge to cross the cabin to him. She could not let him see her fear. "Because I have found him. You. I waited and wished with Moiraine. I won't with Mirella. She is going to give me your bond." Mirella would if she had to drag the woman to Tar Valon and back by her hair. For that matter, she might drag her just for the principle of it. "Don't say anything," she said sharply when he opened his mouth. Her fingers brushed her belt pouch, where his heavy gold signet ring lay wrapped in a silk handkerchief. With an effort, she moderated her tone. He was ill, and harsh words never helped sickness. It was an effort, though. She wanted to berate him up one side and down the other, wanted to pull her braid out by the roots every time she thought of him and that woman. Fighting to keep her voice calm, she went on. In the Two Rivers, Lan, when somebody gives another a ring, they are betrothed. That was a lie, and she half expected him to jump to his feet in outrage, but he only blinked warily. Besides, she had read about the notion in a story. We have been betrothed long enough. We are going to be married today. I used to pray for that, he said softly, then shook his head. You know why it can't be, Nynaeve. And even if it could, Mirella... Despite all her promises to keep her temper, to be gentle, she embraced Sidar and stuffed a gag of air into his mouth before he could confess what she did not want to hear. So long as he did not confess, she could pretend nothing had happened. When she got hold of Mirella, though... Opals pressed hard into her palm, and her hand leaped from her braid as if burned. She occupied her fingers with brushing his hair again, while he glared at her indignantly above his gaping mouth. "A small lesson for you in the difference between wives and other women," she said lightly. "Such a struggle. I would appreciate it very much if you did not mention Mirella's name again in my presence. Do you understand?" He nodded, and she released the flow, but as soon as he had worked his jaw a moment, he said, "Naming no names, Nynaeve, you know she's aware of everything I feel through the bond. If we were man and wife..." She thought her face might burst into flame. She had never thought of that, bloody Mirella. "Is there any way to make sure she knows it is me?" she said finally, and her cheeks nearly did flash to fire, especially when he fell back against the cabin wall, laughing in astonishment. "Light, Nynaeve! You are a hawk. Light. I haven't laughed since..." His mirth faded, the coldness that had dimmed in his eyes for an instant returning. "I do wish it could be, Nynaeve, but..." "It can and will," she broke in. "Men always seem to get the upper hand if you let them talk too long." She plumped herself down on his knees. They were not married yet, true, but he was softer than the unpadded benches on this boat. She shifted a bit to make herself more comfortable. Well, no harder than the benches, anyway. "You might as well reconcile yourself, Lan Mandragoran. My heart belongs to you, and you've admitted yours belongs to me. You belong to me, and I will not let you go. You will be my warder and my husband, and for a very long time. I will not let you die. Do you understand that? I can be as stubborn as I have to be." "I hadn't noticed," he said, and her eyes narrowed. His tone sounded awfully dry. "As long as you do now," she said firmly. Twisting her neck, she peered through the piercework in the hull behind him, then craned around to peer through the carving at the front of the cabin. Long stone docks thrusting out from the stone quay passed by. All she could see ahead were more docks, and the city gleaming white in the afternoon sun. "Where are we going?" she muttered. "I told them to put us ashore as soon as I had you aboard," Lan said. "It seemed best to get off the river as fast as possible." "You?" She clamped her teeth shut. He had not known where she was headed or why. He had done the best he could with what he did know, and he had saved her life. "I can't go back to the city yet, Lan." Clearing her throat, she changed her tone. However gentle she had to be with him, that much syrup would make her sick up all over again. "I have to go to the Sea Folk ships, to Windrunner. Much better. Light, but not too light, and firm." "Nynaeve, I was right behind your boat. I saw what happened. You were 50 paces ahead of me, and then 50 paces behind, sinking. It had to be Balefire." He did not need to say more. She said it for him, and with more knowledge than he had. "Mogedion," she breathed. Oh, it could have been another of the Forsaken, or one of the Black Aja, perhaps, but she knew. Well, she had beaten Mogedion not once, but twice. She could do so a third time, if necessary. Her face must not have shared her confidence. "Don't be afraid," Lan said, touching her cheek. "Don't ever be afraid while I'm near. If you have to face Mogedion, I'll make sure you are angry enough to channel. I seem to have some talent in that direction." "You'll never make me angry again," she began, and stopped, staring at him wide-eyed. I'm not angry, she said slowly. Not now, but when you need to be. I'm not angry, she laughed. She kicked her feet in delight and pounded her fists on his chest, laughing. Sidar filled her, not just with life and joy, but this time with awe. With feathery flows of air, she stroked his cheeks. I am not angry, Lan, she whispered. Your block is gone. He grinned, sharing her delight, but the grin put no warmth into his eyes. I will take care of you, Lan Mandragoran, she promised silently. I will not let you die. Leaning on his chest, she thought of kissing him, and even... You are not Callie Coplin, she told herself firmly. A sudden horrible thought struck her, all the more horrible because it had not come earlier. The boatman, she said quietly. My bodyguards? Wordlessly he shook his head, and she sighed. Bodyguards. Like they had needed her protection, not the other way around. 4 more deaths to lay at Mogedion's feet. 4 on top of thousands, but these were personal as far as she was concerned. Well, she was not about to settle Mogedion this moment. Getting to her feet, she began seeing what she could do about her clothes. Lan, will you turn the boatmen around? Tell them to row for all they have. As it was, she would not see the palace again before nightfall. And find out if one of them has such a thing as a comb. She could not face Nesta like this. He picked up his coat and sword and gave her a bow. As you command, Aes Sedai. Pursing her lips, she watched the door close behind him. Laughing at her, was he? She would wager someone on Windrunner could perform a marriage, and from what she had seen of the sea folk, she would wager Lan Mandragoran would find himself promising to do as he was told. They would see who laughed then. Lurching and rolling, the boat began to swing around, and her stomach lurched with it. Oh, light, she groaned, sinking onto the bench. Why could she not have lost that along with her block? Holding Sidar, aware of every touch of the air on her skin, only made it worse. Letting go did not help. She was not going to sick up again. She was going to make Lan hers once and for all. This was going to be a wonderful day yet, if only she could stop feeling that storm was on the way. The sun sat luridly just above the rooftops by the time Elaine rapped on the door with her knuckles. Revelers danced and cavorted in the street behind her, filling the air with laughter and song and the scent of perfume. Idly, she wished she had had a chance really to enjoy the festival. A costume like Birgitta's might have been fun. Or even one like that she had seen on the Lady Rissella, one of Tylan's attendants, first thing this morning. As long as she could have kept her mask on. She rapped again, harder. The gray-haired, square-jawed maid opened the door, fury suddenly painting her face when Elaine lowered her green mask. You! What are you doing back? Fury turned to ghastly paleness as Merililla removed her mask, and Adelius and the others did the same. The woman jerked with each ageless face revealed, and even with Saritha's. By that time, maybe she saw what she expected to see. With a sudden cry, the maid tried to push the door shut, but Birgitta darted past Elaine, her feathered shoulder knocking it back open. The servant staggered a few steps, then gathered herself, but whether to run or shout, Birgitta was there before time, gripping her arm just below the shoulder. Easy, Birgitta said firmly. We don't want any fuss or shouting, now do we? It did seem she was only holding the woman's arm, almost supporting her, but the maid stood very straight indeed and very still. Staring wide-eyed at her captor's plume-crested mask, she shook her head slowly. What is your name? Elaine asked, as everyone crowded into the entry hall behind her. The closing door muted the noise from outside. The maid's eyes darted from one face to the next, as if she could not bear to gaze at anyone for long.
Sidora.
You will take us to Rhianna, Sidora. This time Sidora nodded. She looked about to cry. Sidora stiffly led the way upstairs, with Birgitta still holding her arm. Elaine considered telling her to release the woman, but the last thing she wanted was a shouted alarm, and everyone in the house fleeing in all directions. That was why Birgitta used muscle instead of Elaine herself channeling. She thought Sidora was more frightened than hurt, and everybody was to be at least a little frightened this evening.
"In there," Sidora said, nodding to a red door. The door to the room where Nynaeve and she had had that unfortunate interview. She opened it and went in. Rihanna was there, seated with the fireplace carved with the 13 sins at her back, and so were another dozen women Elaine had never seen before, occupying all of the chairs against the pale green walls, sweating with the windows tight and curtains drawn. Most wore Ebudari dresses, though only one possessed the olive skin. Most had lines on their faces and at least a touch of grey, and every last woman of them could channel to one degree or another. Seven wore the red belt. She sighed in spite of herself. When Nynaeve was right, she let you know it until you wanted to scream. Rihanna bounded to her feet in the same red-faced fury Sidora had shown, and her first words were almost identical as well. "You! How dare you show your face!" Words and fury drained away together for the same reason, too, as Mirrolilla and the others entered on Elaine's heels. A yellow-haired woman in red belt and plunging neckline made a faint sound as her eyes rolled up in her head and she slid bonelessly from her red chair. No one moved to help her. No one even glanced at Birgitta as she escorted Sidora to a corner and planted her there. No one seemed to breathe. Elaine felt a great desire to shout, "Boo!" just to see what would happen. Rihanna swayed, white-faced, and visibly tried to gather herself with slight success. It took her only a moment to scan the five cool-faced Aes Sedai lined up before the door and decide who must be in charge. She wobbled across the floor tiles to Mirrolilla and sank to her knees, head bowed.
"Forgive us, Aes Sedai."
Her voice was worshipful, and only a little steadier than her knees had been. She babbled, in fact. "We are only a few friends. We have done nothing, certainly nothing to bring discredit to Aes Sedai. I swear that, whatever this girl has told you. We would have told you of her, but we were afraid. We only meet to talk. She has a friend, Aes Sedai. Did you catch her, too? I can describe her for you, Aes Sedai. Whatever you wish we will do, I swear we—" Mirrolilla cleared her throat loudly.
"Your name is Rihanna Corley, I believe."
Rihanna flinched and whispered that it was, still peering at the floor at the Grey Sister's feet. "I fear you must address yourself to Elaine Sedai, Rihanna." Rihanna's head jerked up in a most satisfactory way. She stared at Mirrolilla, then by slow increments turned eyes as big as her face to Elaine. She licked her lips. She drew a deep, long breath. Twisting around on her knees to face Elaine, she bowed her head once more.
"I beg your forgiveness, Aes Sedai," she said leadenly. "I did not know. I could not—"
Another long, hopeless breath.
"Whatever punishment you decree, we accept humbly, of course. But please, I beg you to believe that—"
"Oh, stand up," Elaine broke in impatiently. She had wanted to make this woman acknowledge her as much as she had Mirrolilla or any of the others, but the groveling sickened her. "That's right. Stand on your feet." She waited until Rihanna complied, then walked over and sat in the woman's chair. There was no need for cringing, but she wanted no doubts who was in charge. "Do you still deny knowledge of the Bowl of the Winds, Rihanna?" Rihanna spread her hands.
"Aes Sedai," she said guilelessly, "none of us would ever use a Terangreal, much less an Angreal or Saangreal."
Guileless and wary as a fox in a city.
"I assure you we make no pretense of being anything even near to Aes Sedai. We are just these few friends, you see, tied together by once having been allowed to enter the White Tower. That is all."
"Just these few friends," Elaine said dryly over steepled fingers. "And Garinia, of course, and Berowyn, and Dereys, and Elise."
"Yes," Rihanna said reluctantly. "And them?"
Elaine shook her head very slowly. "Rihanna, the White Tower knows about your kin. The Tower has always known." A dark woman with a Tyran look to her, though wearing a blue and white silk vest with the sigil of the Goldsmiths' Guild, gave a strangled scream and pressed both plump hands to her mouth. A lean, graying Saldaean wearing the red belt crumpled with a sigh to join the yellow-haired woman on the floor, and two more swayed as if they might. For her part, Rihanna looked at the sisters in front of the door for confirmation and saw it, as she thought. Marilla's face was more icy than serene, and Saritha grimaced before she could stop herself. Van Deen and Carianna were both tight-lipped, and even Adelias seemed included, turning her head this way and that to study the women along the walls as she might have insects previously unknown to her. Of course, what Rihanna saw and what was were not the same. They had all accepted Elaine's decision, but no amount of "yes, Elaine" could make them like it. They would have been here 2 hours ago if not for a great deal of "but Elaine" tossed in. Sometimes leading meant herding. Rihanna did not faint, but fear filled her face, and she raised pleading hands. "Do you mean to destroy the kin? Why now, after so long? What have we done that you should come down on us now?" "No one will destroy you," Elaine told her. "Carianna, since nobody else is going to help those two, would you, please?" Jumps and blushes ran around the room, and before Carianna could move, two women were crouching over each one who had fainted, lifting her up and waving smelling salts under her nose. "The Ammerlin seat desires every woman who can channel to be connected to the tower," Elaine went on. "The offer is open to any of the kin who wish to accept." Had she woven flows of air around every one of those women, she could not have frozen them more still. Had she squeezed those flows tight, she could not have produced more bulging eyes. One of the women who had fainted suddenly gasped and coughed, pushing away the tiny vial of salts that had been held still too long. That broke everyone free in a deluge of voices. "We can become Aes Sedai after all?" the Tyran in the goldsmith's vest asked excitedly, at the same time that a round-faced woman with a red belt at least twice as long as anyone else's burst out with, "They will let us learn? They will teach us again?" A deluge of painfully eager voices. "We can really—" and "They will let us?" from every side. Rihanna rounded on them fiercely. "Ivara, Sumeko, all of you, you forget yourselves. You speak in front of Aes Sedai. You speak in front of Aes Sedai." She passed a hand over her face, trembling. An embarrassed silence descended. Eyes fell and blushes rose. With all those lined faces, all that gray and white hair, Elaine still was minded of nothing so much as a group of novices having a pillow fight after last had told when the mistress of novices walked in. Hesitantly, Rihanna looked at her across her fingertips. "We truly will be allowed to return to the tower," she mumbled into her hand. Elaine nodded. "Those who can learn to become Aes Sedai will have the chance, and there will be a place for all. For any woman who can channel." Unshed tears shone in Rihanna's eyes. Elaine was not sure, but she thought the woman whispered, "I can be green." It was hard not to rush over and throw her arms around her. None of the other Aes Sedai showed any signs of giving way to emotion, and Marilla certainly was of sterner stuff. "If I may ask a question, Elaine. Rihanna, how many of you will we be taking in?" Doubtless that pause covered a change from "how many wilders and failures." If Rihanna noticed or suspected, she ignored it or did not care. "I cannot believe there are any who would refuse the offer," she said breathlessly. "It may take some time to send word to everyone. We remain spread out, you see, so—" She laughed, a touch nervously and still not far from tears. "So Aes Sedai would not notice us. At present there are 1,783 names on the roll." Most Aes Sedai learned to cover shock with an outward show of calm, and only Saritha allowed her eyes to widen. She also mouthed silent words, but Elaine knew her well enough to read her lips. 2,000 wilders, light help us. Elaine made a great show of adjusting her skirts until she was sure her own face was under control. Light help them indeed. Rihanna misunderstood the silence. "You expected more? Accidents do take some every year, or natural deaths, as with everyone else, and I fear the kin have grown fewer in the last 1,000 years. Perhaps we have been too cautious in approaching women when they leave the White Tower, but there has always been the fear that one of them might report being questioned, and... We are not disappointed in the least, Elaine assured her, making soothing gestures. Disappointed? She very nearly giggled hysterically. There were nearly twice as many kinswomen as there were Aes Sedai. Egwene could never say she had not done her part to bring women who could channel to the tower. But if the kin refused Wilders, she must stick to the point. Conscripting the kin had only been incidental. Rihanna, she said gently, do you think perhaps you might happen to recall where the Bowl of the Winds is now? Rihanna blushed a sunset. We've never touched them, Elaine, said I. I don't know why they were gathered. I've never heard of this Bowl of the Winds, but there is a storeroom, such as you describe, over... Below stairs a woman channeled briefly. Someone screamed in purest terror. Elaine was on her feet in a flash, as were they all. From somewhere in that feathered dress, Birgitta produced a dagger. That must have been Darys, Rihanna said. She's the only other one here. Elaine darted forward and caught her arm as she started for the door. You aren't green yet, she murmured, and was rewarded with a lovely dimpled smile, surprised and pleased and diffident all at once. We will handle this, Rihanna. Marilla and the others arrayed themselves to either side, ready to follow Elaine out, but Birgitta was at the door before any of them, grinning as she put hand to latch. Elaine swallowed and said nothing. That was the warder's honor, so the Gaidine said. First to go in, last to come out. But she still filled herself with Sidar, ready to crush anything that threatened her warder. The door opened before Birgitta could lift the latch. Matt sauntered in, pushing the slender maid Elaine remembered ahead of him. I thought you might be here. He grinned insolently, ignoring Darice's glares, and went on. When I found a bloody great lot of warders drinking at my least favorite tavern. I've just come back from following a woman to the Rahad, to the top floor of a house with nobody living on it, to be precise. After she left, the floor was so dusty I could see right away which room she'd gone to. There's a flaming big rusted lock on the door, but I'll bet 1,000 crowns to a kick in the bottom your bold is behind it. Darys aimed a kick at him, and he pushed her away, pulling a small knife from his belt to bounce on his palm. Will one of you tell this wildcat watchdog whose side I'm on? Women with knives make me uneasy these days. We already know all about that, Matt, Elaine said. Well, they had been just about to learn all about it, and the stunned look on his face was priceless. She felt something from Birgitta. The other woman gazed at her without any particular expression, but that little knot of emotion in the back of Elaine's head radiated disapproval. Avienda probably would not think much of it either. Opening her mouth was one of the most difficult things Elaine had ever done. I must thank you, though, Matt. It is entirely due to you that we have found what we were looking for. His gaping astonishment was almost worth the agony. He closed his mouth quickly, though opening it again to say, Then let's hire a boat and fetch this bloody bowl. With any luck we can leave Ebu Dar tonight. That is ridiculous, Matt, and don't tell me I'm demeaning you. We are not crawling about the Rahad in the dark, and we are not leaving Ebu Dar until we have used the bowl. He tried to argue, of course, but Darys took the opportunity of his attention being elsewhere to try kicking him again. He dodged around Birgitta, yelping for somebody to help him, while the slender woman darted after him. "'He is your warder, Elaine Sedai?' Rihanna asked doubtfully. "'Light, no, Birgitta is.' Rihanna's mouth fell open. Having answered a question, Elaine asked one, a question she could not have brought herself to ask another sister. "'Rihanna, if you don't mind telling me, how old are you?' The woman hesitated, glancing at Matt, but he was still dodging to keep a grinning Birgitta between him and Darys. "'My next naming day,' Rihanna said, as if it was the most ordinary thing in the world, "'will be my 412th. Marilla fainted dead away. Chapter 32 Sealed to the Flame Elida Doavrinia Royhan sat regally in the Ammerlin seat, the tall vine-carved chair painted now in only 6 colors instead of 7, a 6-striped stole on her shoulders, and ran her gaze around the circular hall of the tower. The sitter's painted chairs had been rearranged along the stair-fronted dais that encircled the chamber beneath the great dome, spaced out to account for only 6 ajahs instead of 7 now, and 18 sitters stood obediently. Young Althor knelt quietly beside the Ammerlin seat. He would not speak unless given leave, which he would not receive today. Today he was merely another symbol of her power, and the 12 most favored sitters glowed with the link that she herself controlled to keep him safe. "The greater consensus is achieved, Mother," Alviarin said meekly at her shoulder, bowing humbly against the flame-topped staff. Down on the floor below the dais, Shiriam screamed wildly and had to be restrained by the tower guard at her side. The red sister shielding her sneered in contempt. Romanda and Lelaine clung to a cold outward dignity, but most of the others shielded and guarded on the floor wept quietly, perhaps in relief that only 4 women had been given the ultimate penalty, perhaps in fear of what else was to come. The most ashen faces belonged to the 3 who had dared sit in a rebel hall for the now-dissolved blue. Every rebel had been cast out from her Aja until Elida granted permission to request reacceptance. But the one-time blues knew they confronted difficult years working their way into her good graces, years before they would be allowed to enter any Aja at all. Until then, they lay in the palm of her hand. She stood, and it seemed the one power flowing through her from the circle was a manifestation of her power. The hall concurs with the will of the Ammerlin seat. Let Romanda be the first to be birched. Romanda's head jerked. Let her see how much dignity she could retain until her stilling. Elida gestured curtly. Take the prisoners away, and bring in the first of the poor deluded sisters who followed them. I will accept their submission. There was a cry among the prisoners, and one tore free from the guard, gripping her arm. Egwene Alvear threw herself onto the steps at Elida's feet, hands outstretched, tears streaming down her cheeks. "Forgive me, mother," the girl wept. "I repent. I will submit. I do submit. Please, do not still me." Brokenly she sagged, face down, shoulders shaking with sobs. "Please, mother, I repent. I do." "The Ammerlin seat can show mercy," Elida said exultantly. The White Tower had to lose Lelaine and Romanda and Shiriam as examples, but she could keep this girl's strength. She was the White Tower. "Egwene Alvear, you have rebelled against your Ammerlin, but I will show mercy. You will be dressed in novice white again, until I myself judge you ready to be raised further. But this very day you shall be the first to take a 4th oath on the oath rod of fealty and obedience to the Ammerlin seat." The prisoners began falling on their knees, crying out to be allowed to take that oath, to prove their true submission. Lelaine was one of the first, and neither Romanda nor Shiriam the last. Egwene crawled up the steps to kiss the hem of Elida's dress. "I yield myself to your will, mother," she murmured through her tears. "Thank you. Oh, thank you." Alviarin seized Elida's shoulder, shook her. "Wake up, you fool woman," she growled. Elida's eyes popped open to the dim light of a single lamp held by Alviarin, bending over her bed with a hand on her shoulder. Still only half awake, she mumbled, "What did you say?" "I said, please wake up, mother," Alviarin replied coolly. "Kovarla Baldin has returned from Kyrian." Elida shook her head, trying to clear away the tag end of the dream. "So soon? I did not expect them for another week at least. Kovarla, you say? Where is Galina?" Foolish questions. Alviarin would not know what she meant. But in that cool, crystalline tone, the woman said, "She believes Galina dead or a prisoner. I fear the news is not good." What Alviarin should or should not know rushed out of Elida's head. "Tell me," she demanded, throwing off the silk sheet, but as she rose and belted a silk robe over her nightdress, she heard only snatches. A battle. Hordes of Aiel women channeling. Althor gone. Disaster. Distractedly, she noticed that Alviarin was neatly garbed in a silver-embroidered white dress with the keeper's stole around her neck. The woman had waited till she clothed herself to bring her this. The case clock in her study softly chimed second low as she entered the sitting room. The small hours of the morning, the worst time to receive dire news. Kovarla rose hastily from one of the red cushioned armchairs, her implacable face sagging with weariness and worry, and knelt to kiss Elida's ring. Her dark riding dress still bore the dust of travel, and her pale hair needed a brush, but she had donned the shawl she had worn as long as Elida had been alive. Elida barely waited for the woman's lips to touch the great serpent before pulling her hand away. "Why were you sent?" she said curtly. Snatching up her knitting from where she had left it in a chair, she sat and began to work the long ivory needles. Knitting served many of the same purposes as fondling her carved ivory miniatures, and she surely needed soothing now. Knitting helped her think, too. She had to think. "Where is Katerina?" If Galena was dead, Katerina should have taken charge ahead of Koiran. Elida had made it clear that once Althor was taken, the Red Aja was in charge. Kovarla stood slowly, as if uncertain she should. Her hands tightened on the red-fringed shawl looped over her arms. "Katerina is among the missing, Mother. I stand highest among those who—" Her words trailed off, as Elida stared at her, fingers frozen in the act of passing wool over one of the needles. Kovarla swallowed and shifted her feet. "How many, daughter?" Elida asked finally. She could not believe her voice was so calm. "I cannot say how many escaped, Mother," Kovarla said hesitantly. "We dared not wait to make a thorough search, and—" "How many?" Elida shouted. With a shudder, she made herself concentrate on her knitting. Giving way to anger was weakness. Loop the yarn, pull through, and push down. Soothing motions. I brought 11 other sisters with me, Mother." The woman paused, breathing hard, and then, when Elida said nothing, rushed on. "Others may be making their way back, Mother. Gawain refused to wait longer, and we dared not remain without him and his younglings, not with so many Aiel about, and the—" Elida did not hear. 12 returned. Had any more escaped, they would have sped back to Tar Valon, would have been here as soon as Kovarla, surely. Even if one or two were injured, traveling slowly. 12 out of 39. The tower had not suffered a disaster of this magnitude even during the Trolloc Wars. "These Aiel wilders must be taught a lesson," she said, trampling over whatever Kovarla was babbling. Galena had thought she could use Aiel to divert Aiel. What a fool the woman had been. "We will rescue the sisters they hold prisoner and teach them what it means to defy Aes Sedai. And we will take Althor again." She would not let him get away, not if she had to personally lead the entire White Tower to take him. The foretelling had been certain. She would triumph! Casting an uneasy glance at Alviarin, Kovarla shifted her feet again. "Mother, those men—" "I think—" "Do not think," Elida snapped. Her hands clasped the knitting needles convulsively, and she leaned forward so fiercely that Kovarla actually raised a hand, as though to fend off an attack. Alviarin's presence had slipped from Elida's mind. Well, the woman knew what she knew now. That could be dealt with later. "You have maintained secrecy, Kovarla, aside from informing the keeper?"
"Oh, yes, Mother," Kovarla said hastily. Her head bobbed with eagerness, glad that she had done something right. "I entered the city alone, and hid my face until I reached Alviarin. Gawain meant to accompany me, but the bridge guards refused to let any member of the younglings pass."
"Forget Gawain Trakand," Elida ordered sourly. That young man remained alive to trouble her plans, it seemed. If Galena did turn out to be alive still, she would pay for failing in that, on top of letting Althor escape. "You will leave the city as circumspectly as you entered, daughter, and keep yourself and the others well hidden in one of the villages beyond the bridge towns until I send for you. Dorlan will do nicely." They would have to sleep in barns in that tiny hamlet which had no inn, the least their bungling deserved. "Go, now, and pray that someone above you does arrive soon. The Hall will demand amends for this unparalleled catastrophe, and at the moment it seems you stand highest among those at fault. Go!" Kovarla's face went white. She tottered so, making her curtsy to leave. Elida thought she might fall. Bunglers! She was surrounded by fools, traitors, and bunglers! As soon as Elida heard the outer door close, she hurled down her knitting and sprang to her feet, rounding on Alviarin. "Why have I not heard of this before? If Althor escaped, what was it you said, 7 days ago? If he escaped 7 days ago, someone's eyes and ears must have seen him. Why was I not informed?" "I can only pass on to you what the Ajahs passed to me, Mother." Alviarin adjusted her stole calmly, not a whit ruffled. "Do you really mean to court a third debacle by attempting to rescue the captives?" Elida sniffed dismissively. "Do you really believe Wilders can stand before Aes Sedai? Galena let herself be surprised. She must have." She frowned. "What do you mean, a third debacle?" "You didn't listen, Mother." Shockingly, Alviarin sat without being given permission, crossing her knees and serenely arranging her skirts. Kovarla thought they might have held out against the Wilders, though I believe she is nowhere near as certain as she tried to pretend. But the men were another matter. Several hundred of them in black coats, all channeling. She was very certain of that, and so were the others, apparently. Living weapons, she called them. I think she nearly soiled herself just remembering. Elida stood as if pole-axed. Several hundred? Impossible. There can't be more than... She walked to a table that seemed all ivory and gilt, and poured herself a goblet of wine punch. The lip of the crystal pitcher rattled against the crystal goblet, and almost as much punch went onto the golden tray. "Since Althor can travel," Alviarin said suddenly, "it seems logical, at least, that some of these men can too. Kovarla is quite sure that was how they arrived. I suppose he is rather upset at his treatment." Kovarla seemed somewhat uneasy about it. She implied that a number of the sisters were. He might feel he owes you something. It would not be pleasant to have those men suddenly stepping out of thin air right here in the tower, would it? Elida practically tossed the punch down her throat. Galena had been instructed to begin making Althor supple. If he came for revenge, if there really were hundreds of men who could channel, or even 100, she had to think. Of course, if they were coming, I believe they would have by now. They would not have wasted surprise. Perhaps even Althor doesn't wish to confront the full tower. I suppose they have all returned to Camelin, to their black tower. Which means, I fear, that Tovain has a most unpleasant shock awaiting her. "Then an order for her to return immediately," Elida said hoarsely. The punch did not seem to help. She turned and gave a start to find Alviarin right in front of her. Maybe there were not even 100... Not even 100? At sunset, 10 would have seemed madness. But she could not take the chance. "Write it out yourself, Alviarin. Now, right now." "And how is it to be gotten to her?" Alviarin tilted her head, icily curious. For some reason she wore a faint smile. "None of us can travel. The ships will put Tovain and her party ashore in Andor any day now, if they have not already. You told her to divide into small groups and avoid villages so as to give no warning." "No, Elida. I am afraid Tovain will regather her forces near Camelin and attack the Black Tower without any word from us reaching her." Elida gasped. The woman had just called her by name. And before she could begin to splutter with outrage, worse came. "I think you are in great trouble, Elida." Cold eyes stared into Elida's, and cold words slid smoothly from Alviarin's smiling lips. "Sooner or later the Hall will learn of the disaster with Althor. Galena might have satisfied the Hall, possibly, but I doubt Kovarla will. They will want someone higher to pay. And sooner or later we will all learn Tovain's fate. It will be difficult to keep this on your shoulders, then." Casually she adjusted the Ammerlin stole around Elida's neck. "In fact, it will be impossible if they learn any time soon. You will be stilled, made an example, the way you wanted to make Swan Sanche. but there might be time to recover if you listen to your keeper. You must take good advice. Elida's tongue felt frozen. The threat could not have been clearer. What you have heard tonight is sealed to the flame, she said thickly, but she knew that the words were useless before they were out of her mouth. If you mean to reject my advice. Alviarin paused, then began to turn away. Wait! Elida pulled down the hand she had stretched out unaware. Stripped of the stole, stilled. Even after that, they would make her howl. What? She had to stop and swallow. What advice does my keeper offer? There had to be some way to stop this. Sighing, Alviarin came close again. Closer, in fact. Much too near for anyone to stand to the Ammerlin, their skirts almost touching. First, I fear you must abandon Tovain to whatever comes, for the moment at least. And also Galena and whoever else was taken prisoner, whether by the Aiel or the Ashaman. Any attempted rescue now must mean discovery. Elida nodded slowly. Yes, I can see that. She could not take her horrified eyes away from the other woman's demanding gaze. There had to be a way. This could not be happening. And I think it is time to reconsider your decision about the tower guard. Don't you really think the guard should be increased after all? I can see my way clear to do that. Light! She had to think! So good, Alviarin murmured, and Elida flushed with helpless rage. Tomorrow you will personally search Josane's rooms and Adalorna's. Why under the light would I... The woman tugged her striped stole again, roughly this time, almost as if to yank it off or saw through her neck with it. It seems that Josane found an Angreal some years before and never turned it in. Adalorna did worse, I fear. She removed an Angreal from one of the storerooms without permission. When you have found them, you will announce their punishment immediately. Something quite stiff.